like you to, if you can, I'm just moving my laptop up and down, basically. Peterson, I think we will go with Ntate Makgoba. The way he is, it's fine. It's already 9 o'clock. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, you are on mute.
You're muted, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you so much. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, Deputy Minister. I'm sure it's you. The minister is not around. Good morning. Good morning, Chairperson of ESCOM and team ESCOM, members of the staff, members of the media who are joining us today, South Africans who are watching this interaction between the Standing Committee on Appropriations and ESCOM and the Department of Public Enterprises, the shareholder to shareholder rep at ESCOM. You are all welcome. A very important meeting to all of us, especially because it's the mercury has just gone down these days, and it's very, very cold, I think, throughout the country. So I'm sure we wouldn't have chosen a better time to interact with ESCOM. I won't be taking a lot of time, because I would like to give the Deputy Minister and ESCOM to start interacting with us. We did send an invitation to ESCOM, and we made an indication of the areas that we wanted them to cover. We sent the letter to the Minister, Public Enterprises. I think the Deputy Minister also applied that letter. So that's it's a follow-up to the meetings that we have had before. Well, the Standing Committee on Appropriations, just so that we can recap, and we always say that anyone and everyone who gets money from government, it's our client. In fact, Prof, before ESCOM would come to government and get recapitalization, they wouldn't have, they were not appearing before this committee. But once you start asking money from us, it's like sending an invitation to us. So that's the background. We have gone through the presentation, DM, quite an elaborate presentation. And would like, so we'll give you time limits and have that at the back of your minds, that very detailed that we've read that. And let me make an example, for instance, a slide which talks to what you applied for at NERSA and what you got. It's quite a detailed slide, but for instance, if you were to summarize the slide, we'll say that's how much we wanted, that's the tariff that we wanted, that's what we're given, and that's the impact of that, and what you are going to be doing about it. But if you go to the slide, it's quite detailed. It talks about all the kilowatts and so on and so forth. So, honorable members, allow me to hand over to the Deputy Minister, Honorable Maswale, and the team ESCOM. Would like to say to you, maximum, you don't have to take all the time, but we are giving you up to 10 o'clock. We'll be doing listening in the, and we hope we promise not to interrupt you, not unless there's really something that we see. But I think let's just allow you, DM, and your team to go. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and greetings to the Honorable members of the committee. I will likewise, Chair, welcome the opportunity and indicate forthwith that I will let the interim chair to really take on the presentation. And you have already noted the minister's absence today. There is a couple of meetings that are sitting. We have shared the responsibilities for the attendance to the different meetings. So that accounts for the absence of Minister Godane. The Professor Makhoba is here with the team from ESCOM. Perhaps I should just, without wasting any time, invite them to take the stage in the time you have available, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, Deputy Minister, and honorable members of SCOA. It's a great opportunity that we have been given to come and present, I think, to your committee. You have given us a mandate, and we have prepared ourselves accordingly. We have sent our documents to yourselves. They are quite extensive, but it would be important, I think, for the team of ESCOM that is going to present to highlight only those issues that are relevant, because the details are there in the narrative and also in the presentations of the slides. The team will be commandeered by the GCE, Mr. Andre Direita, and I'll give him the opportunity to start the presentation. But as the chair has indicated, we should be done with by 10 o'clock, and everybody must simply select those slides that highlight the important issues that the committee should grapple with, rather than every slide that you have prepared. Thank you, Chair, Deputy Minister, and Honorable Ministers, Honorable Committee Members. I will hand over now to Mr. Andre Direita to start the presentation. Thank you.
Morning. Chairman, and good morning also to the Honourable Chair, Honourable Deputy Minister, Honourable Members. As the Prof has said, it's a privilege and honour for us to present to you. We are going to try and be as brief as possible. We do have a lot of ground to cover. We've tried to share as much information as possible. And we will now start with our presentation. The agenda clearly is as per the questions raised by SCOA, and without further ado, I would like to hand over to our Chief Financial Officer, Caleb Kassim, to start with his section of the presentation. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee, Deputy Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to try to do the finance section in about 10 minutes. Chair, I think the first important slide is slide 3. Just to recap for the committee members, if we can move to the next slide. Over the period since 2008, if you go back one slide there, Natasha, it just shows that the support that ESCOM has received from government, from the 60 billion initially loan and in the conversion, a subsequent 23 billion equity support in 2015-16. And then as the committee has appropriated in the last financial year, 49 billion, and then we've built in the 56 billion for this financial year. Honorable Chairperson, this totals 188 billion rand of support for ESCOM over the period, which we are very appreciative to ensure we can meet our debt service commitments as and when they become due. Here, if we then move on, I think just to touch on slide 5, if we skip that, next slide. I think this this is an important slide. In terms of the requirements of the appropriation chair for the last financial year, you will see the cash flow statement is firstly draft, but it's not yet, we haven't completed our audit. What we're highlighting here, Chairperson, is that from an inflow perspective for the last financial year, Eskom generated 36.2 billion rand from cash from operations. And then with the government support of 49 billion during the course of the year, it used that to cover the debt service commitments of 70.6 billion, with some of the balance then coming from our cash from operations. Chairperson, you will also see that over the last financial year, Eskom raised debt of 32 billion to cover our investment in capital expenditure. The point I'm highlighting here is that the critical requirements of the appropriation and the support from government, we need to use the government support to service our principal debt as well as the interest, which we've done in the last financial year ended March 2020. And just to highlight the importance and the need again during this financial year, our debt service commitments for FY21, our principal and our interest adds up to 95 billion, of which we will utilize 56 billion from the support. And then our cash from operations that we generate and further debt funding. If we can then move on to slide 8, Natasha, thank you. Continue. I think, stop here. Yeah. Okay, you can leave it here. I think, Chair, what's important, we know that the three funds of that we generate our cash from is obviously the operations, which I've highlighted in the cash flow. Then Eskom raises debt based on what the market appetite and what our balance sheet can carry, and together with the equity support. But I think at the end of this, it ultimately comes into the amount of revenue one generates, because from that revenue, you need to then service your debt service commitments, as well as then get to a situation where you can generate enough return to return to the shareholder in the form of dividends. What we're trying to just highlight here, honorable members, is that in terms of the policy environment, firstly, the electricity pricing policy in 2008 that stated Eskom should, the tariffs should reach cost reflectivity within 5 years, and even what we see on the outlook currently, we don't get to that level by 2023. I'll highlight that in some future slides. It also indicated that the regulator should produce a 10-year price chart, and again, in terms of the Electricity Regulation Act, Eskom must recover its efficient costs and earn a fair return or margin. Chairperson, if I again move on, and I'll come back to the efficient costs later in the slide and where the prices are. If we can then move, Natasha, to the next slide 12, please. You can skip that. Stop here. Go one back. One back, please. Yeah. Honorable Chairperson, I think you've highlighted this. This is just illustrating the difference between the applications that Eskom has made to the regulator from 2014 up until 2022 and what was awarded. And if we just add the difference in terms of the shortfall in revenue over the period, it's 350 billion.
So the CFO, just hold. Honourable member and everybody who's in the meeting, can I request that you mute your mics? The only mic who should be active is the CFO's mic. Please, everybody who's is on the platform, just mute. That's one. Two, honorable members and everybody who's, who's in the meeting, can you please have your videos on? Right? You are live. And the people of South Africa would like to see who they're interacting with. Just a second. If you have got a problem with the connectivity, then it's understandable if your video is off. Right? So that will be my request. Everybody else should have his or her video on, mic muted. Yes.
May I just make a request? I usually experience connection problems once I switch on my video. Yes, sir. That's the only reason why I never use it, even during the assembly, the sitting.
No. Honorable Kong, that's understandable. That's why I said, if someone is having connectivity problem, it's understandable.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
So if you are having that, it's quite understandable. Thank you very much. Sorry, CFO, to interrupt you. Let me allow the CFO to continue, and please bear with us. Just those are the house rules. Thank you so much. CFO, please proceed.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I've explained this slide. Can we go to the next slide, please? I think what we are highlighting in this slide, honorable members, we know that since 2008 to 2019, the cumulative increase in the average price of electricity through the tariff adjustment has been about fivefold. We just want to highlight during that same period, Eskom's debt amount on its balance sheet, you will see that has increased from slightly below 50 billion rand in 2008 to where we found ourselves at the end of 2019, around 440 billion rand worth of gross debt. I think that's an important point to highlight, and I'll try to explain the link when we get to the future slides. If we continue, colleagues, Natasha, to the next slide. Yeah, I think this is an important slide. Honorable members, what I want to highlight here is that the actual return on assets that Eskom has achieved during this period of 2014 to 2019, and we're busy with the 2020 financials, you can see that it's basically hovering around 0%, and then when we make the losses, it goes below the 0%. More importantly, that what you will find that in the NERSA decision of the multi-year price determination 4, that after NERSA has adjusted for the 23 billion support that you've appropriated, the effective returns also get below zero. And what we're saying here, Chairperson, this does not allow Eskom the opportunity to generate enough cash to cover its cost of capital. If I then move on to the next slide, all we're doing here is to just highlight that the price of electricity is currently sitting on this dotted line, whereas previously when NERSA provided a longer term price plot, the cone of acceptable, the lower and upper band, was between 100 cents to 130 cents. And in previous multi-year applications, what we found is institutions like BUSA, EIUG, as well as the IRP, have indicated that the price of electricity should be anywhere between 108 cents to 118 cents. And where we currently are at the end of 2019, at this 80 odd cents level, you can see the gap which creates cash flow pressure for Eskom. Chairperson, if we move to the next slide, I think it shows it a bit better. Yeah, just to highlight, you see in our submission we've made, according to Eskom, we've calculated the gap of the price of electricity to be in the region of 25% between where we find ourselves at the end of MYPD 4 in constant 2020 rand of 100 cents per kilowatt, and all the previous indications from IRPs have said this is anything between 120 to 140 cents. What we are highlighting here, Chair, this is the migration that needs to be closed to get contribute to Eskom sustainability. I think it's appropriate for me, although I've not included in the slides, chairperson and members, to talk about Eskom's cost base. It is in our detailed submitted document. If I just talk on the total primary energy cost, on a compounded average growth rate basis, it increased from 2014 of about 70 billion rand to 2019 of 100 billion rand. That gives you an average compounded growth rate of 7.4% over the period. And if we look at our operating costs and maintenance, which includes employee benefits, that has grown, Chairperson, from 46 billion in 2014 to 52 billion. That average compounded growth rate is 2.4%. What has Eskom also done during this period, especially the last 3 years? We've looked at our capital expenditure, and as we're approaching the end of the new build, which our colleagues will touch on later, our average capital spend in the initial period was averaging around 55 billion per annum, and it peaked at about 60 billion in 2017. Since 2017, Chairperson, that 60 billion, in 2018 we spent 48 billion on capital expenditure, in 2019 we spent 34 billion, and for the last financial year, unaudited number is 24 billion, which shows that from an Eskom's perspective, we've reduced our capital expenditure significantly. We've kept our operating costs and maintenance relatively flat in line with inflation increases. And primary energy, although slightly above inflation, was tracking 7.4% in total. Chairperson, if I then move on, in the interest of time, next slide. Just to highlight from an overall electricity price, a survey that was done by the Statista in 2018 reflects Eskom's price on the lower end there as well as South Africa. The difference between the two, one is obviously at a Munich level and one is at an Eskom level compared to the other countries in that survey. If I move on, Chairperson, the next slide. And similarly, a World Bank report that was done in 2016, specifically focusing on 39 sub-Sahara Africa countries, shows that Eskom at the lower end in terms of the price of electricity compared to other countries in Africa. Then, Chair, I think two more slides from my side. Slide 22, just to bring the committee up to speed in terms of, if we move on, Natasha, thank you. Carry on. Next one. Yep. Sophia, go one back. Thank you. One back. Yep. Chairperson, you will recall and the members that Eskom has reviewed recent decisions of the regulator around the regulatory clearing account, and the decision that was awarded in Eskom's favor by the judge for the years 2015 to 2017. Our understanding in an application says that we don't believe that NERSA had applied the methodology correctly for the RCA, which totals some 26 billion for that period. Chairperson, we've also made a submission for 2018 totaling 14 billion. That this court has not yet sat on the 14 billion decision, but just to highlight, that the principles of the 2018 review are exactly the same as 2016 to 2017. One more point to highlight on this slide. In terms of the RCA application and when a decision is made, Eskom then recovers that at the future point in time. This just indicates the difference in years between when the costs were incurred and when the recovery happens in NERSA's determination of liquidations. And you could see it varies between 3 to 6 years based on historical decisions. Chair, if you allow me, I think an important point for the members to understand, through the regulatory process, Eskom does not recover the time value of money. So these costs that we basically borrowed and these shortfalls in these years, we were funding it through borrowing. Although we recover from a regulatory mechanism the absolute differences that are deemed efficient, there is no allowance for the time value of money and the cost of borrowing. If I then move on, Natasha, you can skip all of this. The only other point, you can continue, Natasha, slide. I think you can go to, yeah, I think you can stop here as the conclusion. Chairperson, there's also the 69 billion, the equity support. We know the decision was in Eskom's favor. However, NERSA has decided to appeal that decision, and we will wait for the process to unfold. I think, Chair, I think the important points to highlight here, we've demonstrated that we believe that the price needs to go up by around 25% in real terms, but there has to be a transition and a mechanism. Well, we understand that it cannot go up, once-off adjustment and the impact on the economy. However, I think the other important point to highlight here is the importance of the user pay principle. And that for government to develop policies to protect vulnerable sectors and vulnerable communities, together with the policymakers and the regulator, as part of this migration, that's an important factor to be taken into account. And at the end of the day, ultimately, if we cannot meet our debt service commitment from the amount that we generate through our operations, Chair, it leaves Eskom in a situation where we then approach yourself and the committee and government for support to meet those debt service. Thank you, Chair, for your time. I'm done with my section.
CEO, continue to ask.
Honourable Chair, thank you very much. If I can now ask Dan Mashiko, who up until very recently was looking after coal purchases, to deal with the next section, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. I'm battling to see the presentation, so I'm going to follow on my screen, and I will highlight on which slide I am. I have really acute connectivity problems, Chair. So I'm afraid if I turn on the video, I may actually lose the entire, a connection. Okay. So, Natasha, the first slide is basically slide number 30. Chair, in line with the conditions that were set on the special appropriation, we undertook an exercise to review all our coal contracts, and in doing that, we basically developed a model that looks at the bottom-up cost of mining per individual mine and contract. And based on that, we compared that to the price that we were paying. And the difference is basically what we deem as a profit margin that the different miners are making. The ARM industry norms and people that were outside the industry norms are the 7 suppliers that we identified where we needed to go and renegotiate. And indeed, we undertaken that particular exercise because we deemed that the higher profit margin that they were making is not justifiable. And we approached these suppliers on individual basis. However, in response, when they counter proposed to our proposal to reduce the costs, they basically wanted Eskom to open up all their, you know, like a contract. Some of them have historical contracts which are, in ESCOM terms, very favorably priced, and they still have a lot of, you know, like a volume to go. And that's basically where they were coming from. And some other suppliers saw an opportunity to basically increase their volume supply, you know, like to ESCOM using, you know, like this particular process. I'm going to move on, Natasha, to the next slide, which is slide 31 of the deck. It's just to give a background that over and above the reduction or the attempt to reduce the contracted prices, especially for those contracts we contracted in 2018 or financial 2019, when we were in emergency procurement, we also optimizing our inventory holding by making sure that the tempo of our supply is optimum, and this is in lieu of, you know, like the low energy, you know, like a demand, and also our plant not performing, you know, quite well. So we are basically seeing our stock levels sitting at a very high level above what, you know, like ESCOM prescribes. You know, ESCOM prescribes overall system 33 days. We're currently sitting around 60 days, and the grid code requires us to keep 20 days. So as ESCOM, we keep, I think, more stock than what the grid code requires. So we optimize, you know, like the stock, because we don't want to stick with a lot of, you know, debt capital as working cost on the stockpile. So in reducing the coal volumes, you know, like it also became a complexity when we're negotiating, because suppliers wanted, you know, like to increase supply to ESCOM, and they wanted, you know, like that part to be, you know, like to be addressed before they can negotiate. And out of the seven suppliers that we identified through our internal process, I think we only had one successful, you know, like outcome from this process, and that particular offer from the supplier, you know, we expecting savings of about, you know, like 127 million rand. It is currently going through our approval process, because it does entail expansion of the contract, which has to be approved internally in ESCOM by board, and then it must also go to National Treasury. But the process is underway. And Chair, the next two slides are basically giving a summary per supplier. You know, you can see supplier one, we have six contracts with them, and they were not also willing, you know, like to deal with individual contracts, which we highlighted. You know, like they wanted to deal with other, you know, like historical contracts, longer term contracts we have with them, which are favorably priced, and their pricing offer on that basically would have meant you would give them a price increase on a lower base contract with a lot of volume to get a small benefit on very short term contracts, which some of them will be expiring in 6 months, and ESCOM becomes, you know, like a cash negative over, you know, like at the period of the total portfolio, you know, like combined. So it was not presenting, you know, like a savings opportunity to ESCOM, and which is why we could not move beyond, you know, like our proposal and their proposal. And the second supplier, similarly, you know, like they offered, you know, like an increase. However, they wanted, you know, like additional contract tenure, which is 3 years, and the 3 year additional contract tenure and the 10% reduction, you know, like on an ESCOM cash basis, you know, like it would have resulted in a contract expansion of about 211%. And, you know, like what we are seeing is that, you know, it does not give us the type of savings that justify or which justify, you know, like adding, you know, like 3 years, you know, like on the supply, whereas we are seeing, you know, like a very low demand, you know, so adding additional coal on an already, you know, like a oversupply, you know, like a ESCOM portfolio for the next 2 years, you know, like it basically, you know, like it's not helping, and it's not presenting a cash positive, you know, like a situation. The third supplier, Chair, you know, like similarly, you know, like they wanted, you know, like us to increase the monthly contract offtake, and also increase, you know, like the total volumes. And basically no major, you know, like a savings we were achieving, and the contracts basically are also close, you know, like to expiring. I'm going to move on to slide 33, which is the last slide on my deck. And the fourth supplier, you know, like the offer received was about a 4% price reduction on two contracts. And also they wanted us to enter into new contracts. contracts with them as part of the process, and their proposal is, Chair, is quite problematic. I mean, it goes outside the confines of the preferential procurement framework, and it will also not be fair to other suppliers who are potentially looking at supplying Eskom through a competitive bid. And the 4%, you know, like a proposal was way below what, you know, like our aspiration as Eskom is. And you know, like a 40 million tons to be added, you know, like for a 4% price reduction, you know, like it did not make business sense for Eskom. Whereas we are seeing very good prices from our open tender process we've run at Arnot, Tutuka, you know, like in other stations. And so, you know, from a cash outflow perspective and savings, you know, like it's cheaper for us to enter into the new contracts and allow these other ones to expire, you know, like in a short period of time and not enter additional, you know, like a coal contracts. Okay, so supplier four, Chair, you know, like the savings opportunities are currently being explored. They have other, you know, like tenders which they've offered through the Kusile, you know, like RFP. The savings opportunities implementation is basically, you know, like based on us, you know, like reducing logistics costs, and the option basically is to collapse the high priced, you know, like a existing contract and enter into the new contract which came through the procurement, you know, like a process, and that's basically what we are negotiating, and we hopefully, you know, like will succeed with that. Yeah. And supplier six, Chair, you know, like we could not achieve any savings, you know, like similarly to the other suppliers where they wanted, you know, like a additional, you know, like a monthly offtake, you know, for a very minimal savings, which basically creates higher cash requirements. And I mean, our problem is not only cost, it's also cash. So we look at both, you know, like scenarios, you know, like which gives us the best positive, you know, like outlook, and we did not, you know, like succeed. And supplier seven, who also has one contract with us, you know, like they also wanted, you know, like an increase on their monthly contractual volume before they can, you know, like engage with us, you know, like I just picked up some background noise, Chair, sorry about that. So we can engage with them. So in a nutshell, Chair, I think supplier four is basically, you know, where we are intending to finalize and get the savings, you know, by transition from a current contract and entering into a new contract we came through the procurement process. And most of these other contracts, Chair, are quite short term, and they were deliberately entered into short term in 2018, you know, like when we had an acute coal shortage, to buy us time to implement our long-term strategy, which is currently underway. And since then, Chair, I think we've been to the market with about 500 pieces for more than 250 million tons, and some of them are in evaluation, and the Arnold one is almost, you know, like a complete, Chair. That's it, Chair Andre. Yeah, that's the last on my deck.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much to Dan. If I can take slide 34 as read, dealing with the declarations of interest, suffice to say that the declarations of interest at senior level management is, as we should expect, and for the board also 100%, some of our more junior employees have had issues to complete the online declaration of interest. But even there, the progress is satisfactory under the circumstances. I'm now going to ask our Group Executive Human Resources, Ms. Elsie Poole, to briefly take us through some of the people issues that were raised.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Good morning to the members. If we can go to slide 35. Chair, I will use my slides so that I don't waste the committee's time. So when you go to slide 35, in the last 12 months, we implemented two levers in terms of addressing the issue of filling our critical vacancies. One of the levers was we were relinking the resources from your head office and support functions to the divisions to make sure that the divisions have full accountability in terms of their mandates. We also had a once-off project which was approved as a special dispensation to fill the critical positions, particularly in transmission, generation, distribution, and ERI. So if you go to slide 36, this is just to give the committee an indication of the Eskom workforce profile. Eskom company employs about 37,000 employees. At Eskom Rotec Industry, our subsidiary, we've got about 6,008, giving us a total complement for the group of 44,000 employees. About 33% are female, and about 87% are black employees. And we're also showing you a breakdown in terms of occupational levels. You will see that the majority of our employees are in the skilled and the semi-skilled categories. In the managerial and professional areas, we've got about 6,500 employees. Our attrition stands at about 3.6%. We've also shown the committee here a breakdown in terms of our employees in the provinces, as well as a breakdown in terms of age. Just to give an indication in terms of our age profile, more than 40% of our employees are under the ages of 35. So if you go to slide 37, we're just giving an update in terms of how many people had been relinked from the head office functions to the divisions. That is just under 9,000 employees, Chair. And we have completed the process of relinking those resources, and we believe that at this point, relatively, we are sufficiently resourced to fulfill our mandate. And the next few slides, I won't go into them. It's just a detailed breakdown of showing where the people moved from and where they have been allocated to. If you go to slide 39, we're also showing a breakdown in terms of our personnel. We're showing personnel in terms of categories, how many operators we have, technicians, artisans, etc., because the question was also raised in terms of we might not be having sufficient resources where we need them. So that we're showing the breakdown, and we're also showing the breakdown over the past few years to also address the issue of we have lost a lot of people over time. If I can use the first line on slide 39, Chair, just to show in terms of your technical, if I show the first line, technical official, you will notice that in 2013, we had about 7,200 employees, and in July, we're sitting at 6,600. So in line with our attrition and in line with our efficiencies as well, we don't believe that that will be a crisis. In other areas, you might find there had been higher attrition, and those are some of the areas we had addressed through the special dispensation that we implemented last year. So basically, Chair, that's our presentation in terms of addressing the issues of the skills and resources at Eskom. I'll end there, Andre. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elsie. Honourable Chair, I'm now going to hand over to our Chief Procurement Officer, Mr. Solly Chichangano, to deal briefly with slide 43.
Thanks, Andre, Chair, and members. I'll not put my video on because my connectivity is also giving me a problem. The slide that Andre referred to is the review of contracts that identified and renegotiated. Similar to what Dan was reporting on the seven suppliers, we also engaged a number of suppliers to ensure that we can get some savings. But what we are showing on slide 43 are the difficulties that we are experiencing as a firm, because suppliers are demanding more volumes, outside the preferential performance, then we will experience what Dan was also referring to, that they will be contravening the preferential performance regulation. But however, we are continuing with other efforts to ensure that we can save some additional money for ESCOM, as the presentation from the CFO has indicated that we are bleeding from ESCOM side, therefore we need additional savings. Thanks, Andre.
Thank you, Solly. Honourable Chair, we are then moving on to slide 45. Mr. Avi Maharaj, who is the project director for the Kusile project, will take us through these slides.
Good morning, Chairman, Deputy Minister, and members of the committee. I want to blame the weather today for the poor connectivity, because I'm also experiencing very intermittent connectivity issues, Chairman. So with your indulgence, I will talk through the slides as put forward and controlled by Natasha. Chairman, in terms of the question and the query posed by the committee, there was clarity being sought with respect to the contractors that have been overpaid. So I've listed the key and the major contracts that are being investigated from at Kusile, these being ABB South Africa. There is a single contract in place with them. Tenova Mining and Minerals, the project has three contracts in place with that company. Tubular Construction Projects, there are two contracts. And Stefanuti Stocks, Basil Reed and Stefanuti Stocks is the JV. Those are two separate contracts. The first four contracts that I have listed, Chairman, are being investigated through the SIU and the NPA. And in terms of the progress, they are still with specialist forensic planners and forensic cost engineers determining the quantums, the exact quantums. The SIU has fed back that they have consulted with and briefed their senior counsel on each of these matters. To date, there's been one particular case or one contract where there have been arrests. That is the investigation into the matter with Tubular Construction Projects. Natasha, next slide, please. I will then share a little bit more detail, Chairman. Specifically with respect to ABB, there are two key matters that are being investigated. The first matter that's being investigated is the at the time of the award of the contract to ABB, there were dates that were utilized that disqualified a supplier and motivation to award to ABB specifically. So that is a forensic planning exercise that is being undertaken to actually prove that particular claim as to the award being potentially irregular. During 2016 and 2017 as well, Chairman, there were four major variation orders that were issued to the supplier. So it goes back to February 2016 and the last being in October 2017. And the sum total of these is just over R1 billion. The investigations are progressing again from a forensic quantification perspective, because the substantiation documentation and the records for these particular variations are either not present or very, very sketchy at best. Moving on, Natasha, to slide number 47. This deals with Tenova. Again, on this particular contract, we are dealing with an estimated value of R735 million, where there was a settlement during March 2016 and January 2017. The particulars to assess and verify the delays and the costs claimed will be put forward to the courts. Slide 48, Natasha, please. With respect to tubular construction, there are two contracts, and it is in this particular contract where arrests have been made last year in December, and the cases are ongoing. There is an additional investigation being undertaken by the SIU, because this contract stemmed out of what is commonly known as a de-scoping. So there was a de-scoping exercise undertaken with GE, the contractor originally contracted to build the air-cooled condensers at Kusile, and this was then subsequently awarded to Tubular. So both sides, the awarding of the work to Tubular and the payment made to Tubular, as well as the de-scoping exercise with GE, are being investigated. The second Tubular contract on slide 49 deals with our wastewater treatment plant. Again, this was a de-scoping exercise where the original contract was awarded to Mott McDonald PDNA, and then later de-scoped and awarded to Tubular. So these investigations, like I mentioned, are underway and being substantiated in terms of the quantums. Slide 50, please, Natasha. Dealing with Stefanuti stocks at Basil Reed, commonly referred to as Package 16 at Kusile, during 2015 up until the end of 2018, there were payments made to the contractor with respect to a settlement agreement, very, very inconsistent in terms of the actual payments made during that period of time, where P's and G's, or preliminaries in general, had varied between 15 and 50 million rand per month. The project director that took over in 2018 put a stop to all of those interim agreements and payments, and the SIU is quantifying these values as well. Slide 51 deals with Stefanuti Stocks Izazi JV. This particular contract was terminated. There were a number of disputes and claims put forward by the contractor, which have been refuted and disputed by Eskom, and the particulars for these claims are being investigated and quantified by the SIU. Slide 52 deals with other contracts in place at Kusile. These particular contracts are being reviewed and investigated internally by Eskom's Audit and Forensic Department, and the investigations there are underway. There are areas within these investigations where the assistance of the SIU is being sought so that we could pursue civil claims against the former employees as well as the companies that are implicated in that. Chairman, I've added in slide 53, and I think this is purely to clarify, there are two very different matters being dealt with. Natasha, next slide, please, 53. Commonly reported in the press, there is the issue around the overpayment around the 4 billion rand, as well as a 5 billion rand that is associated with a separate claim that Eskom has lodged against Tegeta, and this is for non-delivery against the contract that was in place with Tegeta at that point in time. So the distinguishing, it's important to distinguish between the 4 billion rand potential overpayments at Kusile versus the 5 billion rand claim that's been lodged with the business rescue practitioners with respect to Tegeta. Thank you, Chairman. Chairman, I will also deal with very, very briefly, there is a lot of detail that has been supplied as part of the report with respect to the question raised around the Kusile and Medupi power plant put Eskom on the back foot in terms of not allowing adequate time in terms of planning and the front-end engineering and design that's required on large build programs or capital projects of this nature. Natasha, moving on to slides 56 and 57. Kevin, I've tried to summarize in these two particular slides, and I will not go through them, but it provides a high-level summary with respect to the cost overruns for both Medupi and Kusile, and it also deals with some of the issues that Eskom or measures that Eskom has implemented in terms of trying to curb these cost overruns. Slides 58 and 59 just provide the benchmarks for both Medupi and Kusile from a time perspective as well as a cost perspective. And again, it contrasts the front-end engineering and design that's required for capital projects of this nature versus the reality that Eskom was faced with once the decision for Eskom to execute these projects was finally given. So slide 58 provides the cost, the schedule benchmarks, while slide 59 provides the cost benchmarks for both Medupi and Kusile as compared to international benchmarks. I'll not go into the detail. The numbers are there as well as in the report provided. I'm going to skim through from slide 60, Tim. And this elaborates a little bit more on the key drivers for the cost movements, cost escalations, and in many cases, the underestimations made. So in terms of the setup and development, the pressure to actually bring the new capacity online did not assist the teams in terms of adequate time for front-end engineering and design that was required. Slide 61 highlights the fact that the actual execution of the projects started without there being a firm design in place, and in the same breath, trying to meet a very, very fast-tracked schedule. At that point in time, Eskom had accepted that responsibility not to belabor that point and get the projects moving. We also went through the strategy of multiple contracts, so the upfront integrated schedule was very, very disjointed, which subsequently leads to additional claims and movements from one contract to the other, just adds cost to the project overall. Contractor expertise at the time that the contracts for both Medupi and Kusile were awarded was also very much in short supply. At the time of awarding the Medupi and Kusile project, the number of capital projects in the energy sector were at an all-time high, and the expertise required to execute not freely available, and hence the premiums paid as a result of that supply demand in the market. Natasha, moving on to slide 62, project integration with the contract strategy that Eskom pursued, integration is a major issue, which at the time was not fully understood nor catered for. The lack of this integration and contracting strategy has led to a large the quantum in terms of the cost overruns experienced at both Medupi and Kusile. Both projects also experienced a large number of force majeure type strikes for various reasons, and collectively on each of the slides, almost 24 months in terms of the delays as a result of these. Contractor performance and productivity, a key issue that has cost both projects additional money. Moving on to slide 63. I think I've covered this, Chairman, in terms of next slide, please, Natasha. As I mentioned to on slide 63, we cover the issues around the lack of the competent or insufficient supply in terms of the market, and Eskom being left with contractors with resource constraints. Both projects also took on a strategy to partner with multinational engineering companies. For a long time, the integration between Eskom Resources and these multinational engineering companies was not satisfactory in terms of lots of duplication of effort and a lack of understanding of the Eskom and country requirements in terms of governance that led to there not being a common understanding of how to execute. Slide 54, Tim, the latest in the last sort of 2 to 3 years with respect to investigations into the corruption, they need to proceed, but these also lead to delays where the integration effort when a single contractor stops working or is not able to work, that leads to on costs and or delays with other contractors as well. So in as much as we are rectifying the fraudulent activities, these do cause other impacts in terms of the projects themselves. We've also seen a large number of companies go into business rescue and the financial stability. In terms of these, we have large gaps in terms of the project where contractors are no longer able to fulfill their obligations, and these subsequently lead to delays with the contractors that follow on from that work. And in terms of the Eskom processes, in terms of filling that gap, it could take anything between 9 and 24 months before new contractors are engaged and working on site. And like I say, these just leads to there being additional costs and or time delays with the subsequent or follow-on contractors. Chairman, in terms of slides 65, 66, and 67, I will not go through them in detail, but it provides the reasoning and some of the risk mitigation measures that we have put in place at both the projects. The last two slides deal with where the costs are currently, which is slide 68, Natasha. For both Medupi and Kusile, the costs that are indicated there at 145 and 161.4 billion rand respectively have not changed since 2015, which is when the last time the overall business cases for projects were reviewed. All indications that we will complete these projects within those approved, currently approved budgets that we have in place. The last slide deals with the commercial operation status of each of the projects. As you will see that at Medupi, Unit 6 all the way down to Unit 1 are in commercial operation. It's expected that the last unit, Unit 1, will go into commercial operation first quarter of next year. At Kusile, we have one unit that is in commercial operation, and Units 2 and 3 will be done within this current financial year. At Kusile specifically, we are experiencing problems with Unit 3 currently. We are dealing with those issues. There are major technical issues that we are resolving, but we still have the four core course, that we will have Unit 3 into commercial operation within this current financial year from an Eskom perspective. Seven, that brings me to an end. I do see that I've maybe taken 7 minutes more than was allowed. Thank you.
Thanks, Avin. Honourable Chair, with your permission, I know we are over time. If we can quickly run through the remainder of the slides before we hand back to you, just to do a time check, please.
Yeah, that's fine. let me give you up to quarter past, and CEO, please end at quarter past, so that allow the members to also interact with the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. We'll speed it up. Just on the following slide there, Chair, slide 71, we are investigating 39 different contracts with significant cost overruns, and we will in due course report back to the committee on those issues. If I may now hand over to our Chief Legal Counsel, Mr. Bartlett Hewu, who will take us through the cost recovery update. Bartlett.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Deputy Minister, Honourable Members of the Committee, I will take slides 76 to 80 as read in the interest of time. I will be ready to field any questions that members may have. The only thing that I wish to highlight is the recent 3.8 billion rand claim that Eskom and the SIU have made against former executives of Eskom, board members, and also Tageta Exploration and Resources, owners, the Guptas. We are busy with the SIU, as you would have heard from Mr. Maharaj and the GCE, with other continuing investigations in the background. We will be coming back to the committee with a revised report detailing the actions taken towards recoveries. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
CEO?
Thank you very, very much, Bartlett. I will now hand over to Mr. Rulani Matabula, who is our... yes, Honourable Chair. If I may hand over to Mr. Rulani Matabula, who is our Acting Group Executive for Generation, to deal with the load shedding issue.
Thanks, Andre. Honourable Chair and the members of the committee, for the sake of time, allow me to quickly go through this feedback that we have submitted to you. Just an overview of on the July and August recent load shedding that we had. We experienced around 4,000 megawatts loss, which was mainly due to trees at our different plants. We also had an impact due to the unavailability of our Camden power station, which had to be taken off due to unavailability of ashing space. We also at the time had Quebec unit number 2 off, and we also had 3 units, one at Medupi and 2 at Kustile, which were not available to support the grid at the time. We also needed to manage our reserves very well at the time, and that combined had a huge impact on our supply. To manage time, if you look at slide number 82, just an outlook of how the system looks from July 2020 to March 2021, you would realize that our demand and our available capacity shows that we will be constrained for the near future, for the months that we have indicated there. And if you continue on slide 83, it shows the same constraint continuing from April 2021 to March 22, but showing a recovery on available capacity. Just to quickly talk to how we're dealing with this thing and going into the future, on our conclusion, you would realize that the focus is mainly on the unplanned load loss to keep it way below the 11,000 megawatts, also to maintain our diesel supply, and also to bring back the units or to reliability at Medupi and Kusile, as my colleague has alluded. The good news is that we have already started bringing back the units that we have taken off at Camden, so that will help in supporting the grid and minimizing the impact of load shedding going forward. There's a lot of work that we have put in place currently to ensure that we maintain our plant based on our reliability maintenance plan, and that will give us the assurance that we need to keep to meet the demand going forward. Chair, I'm trusting that the rest of the detail is at your disposal and has been read, and I would like to end it here. Thank you.
CEO. CEO.
Thank you very much, Rulani. Honourable Chair, in the interest of time, if I may, yes, Honourable Chair.
No, I think, please.
Yes, Chair?
I think it was quiet, and I think
we I think, in the interest of time, can conclude the presentation here. Okay. Honourable Chair, if we can take the remainder of the presentation, which deals with Eskom's contribution to broad-based black economic empowerment, take that as read, we'd be happy to take any questions that the committee might have on that, but we are trying to respect the time contract, so let's take that as read and hand back to you, and thank you again for the opportunity, Honourable Members and Honourable Chair.
Prof, anything before we come in? DM?
Yeah, I'm trying to unmute myself. I'm very grateful for this opportunity. I think we've given you a snapshot as to the challenges and the opportunities that we have as Eskom, and we value the support, I think, that you give us as a committee. Not only the support, but the guidance, I think, that you provide, which is necessary as part of a democracy, and we value that a lot. Thank you.
Thanks, Prof. PM?
No, I'm covered. I may come back when members engage, whether issues there, I'll then come back at that stage.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Team Eskom. National Treasury, remember we had an interaction with National Treasury yesterday. I don't know, Ravesh, is there anything pressing from your side you'd like to add?
Chair, through you, Chair, there's nothing pressing from my side, thanks. But we have I think we have a separate presentation on the compliance to the conditions, which we can do later, if required.
But can you summarize in a minute compliance?
Chair, through you, in a minute, what I can do is quickly just flight this presentation for you, Chair, and I'll just go you and just take you through to the main slide, which is in terms of the conditions. Basically, what we have here is we have three conditions that were partially complied. And then there were two, conditions that were non-complied with. In terms of, the partial compliance, those three, conditions, three which relate to the debt and interest, payment, schedule, So it wasn't actually in full, or the detail wasn't provided as at the end of March, but they have, subsequently did provide, the detail in terms of the full, repayment schedule, over the life of the loan. And then under condition 9, Chair, through you, in terms of the cost and the, and the timing of, the completion of, Kusile and Madupi, that information now has been provided in the June report, and then condition 12. There was in the SP presentation. Then Chair, quickly on the non-compliance, there was two conditions that were non-compliant with, which is the which is condition number 6, which is in to the disposal of the Eskom finance company, which was a target date of the end of March. So they were not able to to dispose of that, but they are now in the process of a new bidding process, and we understand that that target date is now moved to the end of March 2021. And Chair, then the last condition which was not complied to was which was number 16, which was in relation to the to the implementation of the remuneration standards. I think for DPE's approval with regards to that. And then Chair, lastly, quickly, if I just go through the to the proposed conditions for 2021, we have engaged with DPE, we have engaged with Eskom on the proposed conditions for 2021, and that's been signed off by the it's been signed off by the Minister of Finance, and it has been sent through the two committees, which is COA and SECOA. So at the moment, what we have is that Eskom is reporting its compliance on the on the 1920 conditions until we can then have the okay from the two committees to say that they're happy with the conditions for 2021. I've summarized it very, very quickly. There were 7 slides, but I think that sums it up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ravesh. Please take off your presentation from the screen. Thank you. Thank you, Ravesh. DM, Chair, CEO. A lot of honourable members are just struggling to connect, and courtesy of load shedding. So I'm getting they're just busy calling me here, so they can't effectively execute their oversight responsibility. So that's how far this load shedding goes. But we'll try, honourable members. I got some messages about some of the other members whose mobile phones or computers are about to die, and I would like to start with them. I've got Honorable Nhlanhwini, Honorable Nkwankwa, Honorable Mlenzana. Let's continue then.
Matafa.
Honorable Matafa. Honorable Sheikh.
Dennis Joseph, Chair.
Honorable Joseph. Honorable Taiso. Honorable Taiso.
Peters.
Honorable Peters. Okay. That's it. Honorable Nhlanhwini, Honorable Nkwankwa, Mlenzana, Matafa, Sheikh, Joseph, Taiso, Peters. Let's try maximum. No injury time, honourable members. Please time yourselves. It's 4 minutes, and let's run. Honourable Nhlanhwini.
dark it is where I'm sitting. So anyway, you won't be able to see it. So I'll shoot straight, Chair, to some of the overpayments that were done. I think on slide, I can't remember the slides because it's 99 slides that we have received. There's a one that states 1, 2, 3 until 5, and then number 5, various site service contracts not into the scope of SIU. It's about 180 million. If we can get clearance on that, what is those contracts and overpay the contracts of the service contracts. And then also, Chair, just on the overpaid contracts, yet again, I understand that some of these cases are with law enforcement agency and so forth. But we need also from their internal process of Eskom, how far are they with their internal process, as well with employers that are still with them, and by when will these cases be wrapped up? Because we are not talking here about 10 rand overpayment, we are talking here about billions. And what measures have been put in place to ensure that this overpayment doesn't happen again, with the internal audit process strengthened and all of that? Because it's good and well that you are having the cases with the SIU and all of this other law enforcement agencies, but you within your internal process will also have to strengthen your internal process. So I'd like to know what is the process thereof. And then on the to healthy slide of the raise slide of the 30% of Africans, I would just like to maybe perhaps get a total breakdown within which position are that 33%. It's all and well we are having 30% of African people in positions, but in which position are they? And on the top level, one to see that they are also getting to be your CEOs, CFOs, and all of those things. If we can get a clearer understanding of that. And Chair, I'm running very fast.
Am I still fine?
Because they are rushed a bunch. All right. And then what is the current state of Eskom's cash flow position, taking into account the impact of COVID-19? What is the amount of debt that was projected to be raised for the 2020-21 financial year, and how has this number changed due to the impact of COVID on Eskom's revenue? And that's all for me for now, Chair. I will come back when we have more time. Oh, and
well, then
do I still have 30 seconds?
Yeah.
Let me shoot to slide 36 then. Eskom have showed the employment equity achievement, but how does this compare against the entity's targets? What is the average age of Eskom employers, as age profiles reveal that there is a significant number of staff that are in their twilight years and their careers, and how is Eskom nurturing young talent as part of their succession plan? Thank you, Chair.
There you go, thanks. Honorable Kwankwa. Honorable Kwankwa. Kwankwa, are you there? Honorable Kwankwa, are you there? Okay, Honorable Lenzana, please come in. Honorable Lenzana, please come in. Honorable Matafa, please come in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greetings to the DM, of CEO and the team, and those that are from National Treasury. Chair, I will be very, very brief, but maybe just to start on a lighter note. I'm not happy with my lighting because of for me deja vu, because the last time we went to Eskom for oversight visit, we experienced load shedding. So we're experiencing it again. Chair, maybe let me welcome the presentation and state from the onset that I'm very happy with the detail. It's very detailed. And also to acknowledge the fact that it is this committee that has called for a forensic audit or a forensic investigation as far as the cost overruns on the build program is concerned. Now, a direct question on the overpayments that were uncovered. Are we looking at recovering those particular amounts? Because I hear there was an arrest, there is an investigation, but when the slide where we are looking at the recoveries that we are aiming for, these companies that are identified are not reflecting. The second one, Chair, around overpayments. We have once learned of a three-way invoice verification process that is used in the finance unit of Eskom. Could this overpayment, where there are no pure corruption, be related to this particular process? And if so, what is the status of this particular process? Are we still using it? And if we are using it, what are the safety nets that have been put around this particular process to ensure that there are no leakages? Chair, the third point is on the issue again of forensic audit and investigation. The CEO speaks of companies that are red flagged, and I think he gave a number of 39. I'm interested to know, without discussing the merits, pardon me, how are these contracts identified? Because, Chair, like I always say, when we account as public reps, we account to constituencies. There is a bedding issue around a case that has a contract that is being cancelled. One, it's an African entrepreneur. Two, it's a woman. And this contract is being cancelled. It's around the diesel issue. It will be very interesting to clarify the perception around African contracts or contracts that have been awarded to Africans being targeted. Hence, I'm asking particularly on the process that is being applied. Now, Chair, maybe it would be proper as well, once the investigation around the red flag contract is done, Eskom should report to the committee on the demographics of those particular companies and how do these demographics impact on the BBBEE as well as other transformation programs that Eskom would have implemented. Chair, on the same issue of the contract that is being cancelled, there is subsequently a lot of public debate around the stability and differences in the board of Eskom, with one board member resigning and going public. I just want maybe the GM or the CEO to take us into their confidence on the stability of the board and if whether the board is pulling together. Because in most instances, we have picked up that where the board is not pulling together and there are challenges in terms of top management, all other internal systems collapse because there is no oversight and there is no management intervention where it is required. So it would be important for us to know what is the status of the board and if whether are we happy with the board, since one of the requirements or conditions rather that we have put for Eskom was to strengthen the board. Let me just check my notes. Yeah, no, I think for now, Chair, I will pause there. The last one is on slide 86, Chair. I think the Honorable Ntlangwini spoke on the issue of transformation and localization in terms of contractors that are being deployed to Eskom programs. Now, on slide 86, there is a statement there that speaks on partnering with the best in the world. it will also be good for the committee to be briefed in terms of what specific measures is ESCOM implementing to ensure that there is assistance for the development of localization as well as procurement and entry for small and medium-sized contractors, particularly those that are owned by Africans, because those are the ones that have been excluded in the historical past of our country, and particularly in ESCOM. Hence, Honorable Ntlangwini is asking on those positions in terms of the role of Africans in management as well as in specialized operations of ESCOM. For now, Chair, I will pause there. Maybe just last one.
Done, gone.
Gone. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Honorable Sheikh.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to ESCOM for giving us a very comprehensive report. Gives us a clear understanding of some of the challenges that ESCOM is facing. But I'm also a victim of load shedding, so I don't think I'll be able to stand the test of time, sir, before the meeting is over. I may be in darkness. 26 years later, I thought I was coming into life, but I ended up in darkness. But be that as it may. First question to ESCOM. You speak about electricity theft, which is a major problem in the country, particularly with cable and the theft of electricity. Please tell us what mechanisms you're putting in place to overcome this problem. And added to that will be the issue of non-payment, of course, for services that you are providing. Now, what is clearly we can see here is that the loans that you are getting, bailouts from government, is being used mainly to pay off debt. So this is not actually sustainable or viable. Clearly what it means is that ESCOM is not a viable currently. Now, and the reason why I'm saying this, I have a concern that with the independent power producers that are expected to supply electricity directly through to municipalities, it means there's going to be a less of a demand from ESCOM. However, your cost and your overhead may remain the same, particularly if you look at the amount of money you're talking about, employee benefits and everything. Now, how is that going to impact you? Because it means you're going to generate less income. Your overhead and things are going to be the same. Is that not, does that not mean that you're going to get into more serious trouble than you already are? The other thing is I want to know procurement. My understanding is there's been many people that have been enjoying what we call here evergreen contracts from pre-1994. Can you tell us how many of those pre-1994 evergreen contracts exist today, or in the last contracts that are 10, 15, 20 years old, who are the people, and whether we get any value for money based on current market prices? Then we talk about the overpayment of billions of rand. Now the question that arises is, where is your internal audit mechanism and your oversight mechanism? Where is your chief financial officer and the other, you know, the project directors and project managers and all these people, when these overpayments and things are being made, where are all these people today? How many of these people are now going to be paying the price or already being dealt with as a result of their failure to comply or ensure that the finances of ESCOM has been protected? Now, Kusile, can you tell us what was initially, okay, first of all, it clearly, from your report, it seems like that we did not have the capacity when we thought of this to implement this project. And that's why we've been running in circles since we announced it, and that has cost us dearly. Now the question is, what I want to know is the original cost. What do you think it's going to now end up being, despite the figures that you are giving us, because there's only been delays and delays and delays, and whether you think this thing is going to be completed in due course. Then the question I have in terms of load shedding is, to my understanding, that there was a project that we were busy with, I think it's somewhere in the Zambian border with DRC and things like that to generate more energy and electricity. Can you just tell us what's happening with that? Then I want to know what, and I'll stop here, saying this last one for now. With all the contracts that you have and the contractors that you are giving out, whether it's for supply or services, whatever, what is the percentage of compliance in terms of these contractors having the ability or capacity and delivering timely? Because I'm trying to get a picture of whether we are dealing with people that just do not have the capacity to also provide the services or deliver the goods, but we have to live with them, which costs us more money to escalate them and other problems. So I'd like you to give us that. I'll be okay with it. I'm not sure if I'll survive for the answer.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Joseph.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just would like to say thank you to the management team, Deputy Minister and the management team, stakeholders for the presentation. My first point I want to make, I didn't hear a lot about state capture or corruption, so I'm not sure if Eskom is free of that, or the state capture history, if Eskom is part of that. The other point I would like to say and ask on slide 5, Chairperson, the draft of pre-audit cash flow statement that is presented to us on the slide, I would like to know if that figures will remain the same or if it could change and why if it will change. The fact that it must also be audited. On slide 9, I heard this comment about cost tariff should be cost reflective. Now, if I understand that correctly, it's about the expenditure, the income, and the profit, which Eskom should have been at this stage in our democracy, in our history, as profit, but we're giving money to cover dark holes and for survival of Eskom, which is not good, against the mandate of what Eskom is there for. So just to clarify that, then afterwards it was said in slide 13 that the average price increase is fivefold versus the debt that is tenfold. Now my question is, what does the Constitution say about the provision of electricity at local government level, and what is Eskom's responsibility, an obligation towards the Constitution? There is clear guidance as to why the entity exists and why local government exists to provide electricity, and why Eskom exists, and I think we need to review that as well. Slide 19, Chairperson, maybe skip that one and go to slide 24. The whole issue between NERSA and Eskom, I heard that NERSA was taking into account the appropriations that this parliament has given to Eskom, and then obviously deducted that amount, and then because of that lowered the determination as 3.9 billion as set in 2018. So, and I know there's ongoing cases, but it is actually sad that has happened in the process. Because what's going to happen now, on slide 28, where reference was made to the gap of filling the gap, which is 25%. The point that I need to make, we can't shift that gap to the consumers, Chairperson. What is the restructuring showing us in terms of saving more money for Eskom? Restructuring process, we haven't heard a lot about that. But the gap of 25% cannot be covered by the consumers or even business people. I would like to know, Chairperson, who's negotiating on behalf of Eskom, given the review and the contracts under review? Is Eskom doing it themselves, or are they using consultants to review these contracts? Then the last point I would like to ask Chairperson is point raised by Elsie on slide 35. I would like to know where the artisans fit in. I saw a number of 1,800 for artisans. And I would like to know where does the internship trainees fit in. And then I saw a figure of 4,085, which is just the other. Now that's a huge amount. Yeah, that's a huge amount, and I would like to know where does the pilots fit in, that Eskom also, are they part of that? And then last question, Chairperson, the funding. the completion of Medupi and Kosile, I would like to know, do Eskom need further funding, approval from Parliament? And I've heard the figures that they said on the slide, but I would like to know if they need further approval, if they're going to come back. And I saw after 215 years as a project.
Yeah, right on my overtime. Thank you. Honorable Nkwankwa, please come in. Honorable Nkwankwa? He wrote to me that he was back. It looks like he has been cut.
I'm here.
Oh.
No. I'm sorry. I forgot to unmute myself this time around, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair. No, I got cut off. Connection is a bit of a problem today. I have a few questions. Even my iPad, where I made a lot of my notes, has switched off. It died. But anyway, I've got my notes here right in front of me, Chair. The first question I want to ask Eskom is that perhaps I think time has come for us. Remember when we went on oversight last year, when we first spoke about the overpayments, and then there was a time during the course of this year where no one remembered what these overpayments were about. But I think it's important for us to get I don't know whether you can do an age analysis insofar as overpayments are concerned, for each individual overpayment, to say in future when we get a report, to say this is what is happening with ABC, these are the steps undertaken to try and recoup some of the monies, these are some of the challenges. And then we get an indication of how long the process for each one of those companies where we're trying to recoup money, how long that process would ideally take, so that we're able to monitor it on a regular basis. I think now what is happening is that, yes, the companies, as we saw in one of the slides, I actually noted the names are indicated there, but we don't have specific details around what each process is, how far the process is insofar as each company is concerned and what the challenges are. There's also, Chairperson, the issue that has to do with, I think, companies that are trying to rip off Eskom, where they are charging the taxpayer exorbitant amounts of money. I think those details where Eskom is specifically talking about renegotiating some of the contracts and all of those things, maybe also those things we need details now so that we get to a point where we name and shame companies that continue to try and rip off the taxpayer, because this is the taxpayer's money, it's not their money. The other important issue, there's a slide there, Chairperson, where, for example, Eskom was doing a comparison of, I think, prices, Eskom prices or tariffs, electricity tariffs, with different countries around the world. I do feel like that discussion should be taken further, because it also doesn't actually take into account those are charging prices that are lower than Eskom, so that we get a clearer picture of how they were able to achieve that. The other critical issue is that analysis, it is to a large extent superficial at this point, because it does not give us a lot of contextual issues which are important when it comes to country to country. It just looks at the prices. I think we'd need a detailed analysis so that at some point we're able to make an informed decision to say what is the right way to go. And in fact, it's never a wrong thing if you are cost efficient. If so far as costs are concerned, you are efficient and therefore able to make savings that you can pass on to the consumers. It should never, because other countries in the world are charging more than you are doing, and you are able to actually improve efficiency in the system and charge lower prices, that we think it's a crime. I read an article recently, Chair, that has it was in one of these financial articles where it was talking about incline block tariff purchases per month, which I think, in my view, we've known this thing happens, where the article goes along the lines of saying that it says it goes according to blocks. If you buy electricity at the beginning of the month, it's likely to be cheaper, and if you buy electricity during the course of the month or later on in the month, the price is actually slightly expected to be slightly more. I mean, it's been happening for years. But it would be nice if we can get an account in financial terms. So how does that then impact the financial performance of Eskom? But the problem with that as well is that it makes the pricing structure very complex for the man in the street to understand. It might be that many people are still continuing to buy during the course of the month and therefore are actually wasting a lot of money, giving it into an entity that is not entirely efficient, as it were, and as we understand it. From where I am sitting, the problem of Eskom is not a low electricity tariff issue. From where I'm sitting and the UDM is sitting, the problem here has to do with escalating debt and poor management and issues that have to do with lack of cost inefficiencies. The last question, Chair, I don't want to go into your overtime, is we've been asking, I think it's a question, it's a discussion that we've had for a very long time, but I don't think there has been a concrete response to it. Honorable Sheikh Imam spoke about IPPs, the renewable energy space, to say they are going to start competing with Eskom, and he's quite right in saying once they start connecting municipalities, as is the policy now, for example, what will happen is that the overhead expenses of Eskom will remain the same, right? Which is the cost structure will remain the same, but the revenue will be less. Why is Eskom not allowed, or why is Eskom not having a discussion where it starts playing in the renewable energy space as well? Because the cost, in order for one to be able to set up a farm and all these things, is lower than doing this coal thing, which costs a lot of money.
Round up. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Honorable Kaiso.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm not going to be very long. Perhaps we'll take 2 minutes. And the next 2 minutes we'll give it to the Chair, I mean Honorable Dipuo. Let me start here. I'm covered by largely by what Honorable have said with regard to the issue of the 4 billion overpayment and the picture that was outlined during their input. Now, I just want to know, ask this direct question. In the condition, it is mentioned that now Eskom did not fail to comply with the disposal of the financial company, but I didn't get it quite clear. What are the reasons behind that? And secondly, is the issue of remuneration standards, remuneration standard that they did not implement. I also want to know what is the reason beyond that, because I immediately want to link that question with the issue of the performance bonus that that was said that they must stop a payment of performance bonus for their executive managers or most senior managers there at the company at some stage when we interacted with them. So I just want to know whether did they stop actually that implementation when they are referring to the remuneration standards. Now let me quickly come to this one. During this year, when we interacted with Eskom, we once talked about the 4 billion rand that we did not know how did Eskom pay it out to those contractors. And Eskom confirmed that there's an overpayment. But then there came during the process of restructuring at Eskom, Professor Makhoba came in when we were in a meeting, in one meeting, and told us we don't know anything about Eskom as MPs when we were talking about those overpayments. And subsequent to that, there was a press statement. There was a press statement, perhaps which seek to justify that wrong perception, that we seem not to know anything as members of MP when we talked about what Eskom told us about during that term. And that statement seemingly seek to justify what Professor was saying, that MPs seem not to be knowing anything about Eskom. Now, would you now be in a position to retract and apologize for that utterance in that meeting, because we take our task as MPs very serious. So we would not be in a position to come and bring lies here in the we don't know what informed that press statement, which we now get in the some of the details now in this meeting of some of the issues which were raised by that press statement. Now, I would like you to withdraw that utterance. Just to sum up. Let me pause here, Chair. I'll come back at some stage. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Honourable Tipuo. There's nothing to be donated to you from Honourable Kaiso. Please, Honourable Peters, come in.
I was so happy. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Honourable Kaiso, you raised my hopes. I want to take this opportunity to thank the Deputy Minister and the staff as well as the CEO and officials from ESCOM for the presentation. But Chairperson, I'm worried because of time issues. I just wanted to find out from ESCOM with regards to the 1 meter or one household, 1 meter campaign with regards to the payment culture for services in ESCOM, because we believed at the time as a committee that that could contribute. But also taking into consideration the impact of COVID on municipalities, because household income has reduced and therefore the rate, payment for services has also drastically gone down. How is the payment record for municipalities? But in particular, Chairperson, we don't seem to get to know from ESCOM themselves how much business owes ESCOM, and especially business, big business that makes money from doing business with ESCOM. We raised this question in the last round, and I don't, in the presentations, I didn't get that coming to the fore. With regard to engagement with suppliers for renegotiation, I want to know why only 7 suppliers, because ESCOM suppliers is not only the 7, but also it looks like it's a small fry, the 138 million there and whatever. But also, I remember when the committee was talking to the renegotiation of contracts, we were also talking to the evergreeners, because there are those big contracts that are still remaining with about 46 years. And I remember myself specifically saying, I can't understand how these contracts were entered into that take generations into consideration, because if you're still left with 46 years or 49 years, it's going to take some time. But also, Chairperson, the issue of contracting models for ESCOM has been raised for many years, and it doesn't look like ESCOM is really ready to look at its contracting and project management capabilities. So it's important that we get to know from ESCOM this thing. On slide 39, the HR manager spoke to the headcount and all those others. I just want to find out, why does it look like the engineering capacity in ESCOM gets reduced quite significantly? If you took the slide that shows from the year 2013
incompetence, because there is no way you can say that you did not see that you are overpaying this particular company. But also, Chairperson, I want to know from the chair and the CEO, is there any of these companies that you have listed there which were penalized by the Competition Commission for that fraud and corruption that was picked up in the construction cartel saga? Because you would know that there was a construction cartel issue, and some of the companies that are also doing business with Eskom were found on the wrong side of the law. I would want to know, is there any one or two or three of those companies that also again find themselves on the list of the those who have been overpaid? Lastly, Chairperson, with regards to the renewable energy program, there was a process many years ago, I think around 2013, just before, yes, just after window one, and in preparation for window two and window three, there was a proposal, there was a decision that was encapsulated in the Green Economy Accord that actually emphasized the need for Eskom to contract to companies that are procuring their components. At least each company was supposed to have more than 30% of their components having been manufactured in South Africa. There was much talk about the mirrors, there was much talk about the current inventors, and there was quite a number of companies that were starting to emerge in that particular field, especially with the photovoltaic and the solar panels, as well as the wind turbines. I remember there was a company in the Eastern Cape at Kuha that was doing this. So is it not a requirement that Eskom actually make it possible that they don't sign any PPA or power purchase agreement with a company that does not procure locally for the renewable energy bill? Thank you, Chairperson.
Peter, I can see you planned for the donation, which never came. Darren?
Chairperson.
Honorable Mlenzana said he couldn't connect, but he was going to send his question to you. Did you get it?
No, I haven't received it yet, Chairperson.
You haven't received anything. Let me swear out now. Time is 11. Let me try to be quick with my question. Thank you. I'm still trying to tie myself. quickly, Chairperson, where is the COO, Mr. Oppenhauser? We have got a new CEO, and Mr. Oppenhauser, when he interacted with him, he would remember some of these things, right? I'm sure this talks to the, if I may just start there, the question of the 4 billion rand is not 5 billion rand. I think it was mistaken to say that, and we corrected in our statement, 4 billion rand. Chairperson, this amount was not, it was given to us voluntarily by the CEO, that in our investigation we found out that there's a company which has been overpaid by 4 billion rand, and we are busy negotiating them, and they are also agreeing that they are overpaid. And then we're told that they're in the process of paying that money back. There was no issue about that. There was no investigation where at Eskom. So hence, the question keeps on coming. What changed between then and our last in interaction? Chairperson, there's a matter involving the CEO, Mr. Oppenhauser, where it is, in fact, not now alleged, because there is the investigation by Advocate Kasim, which found that Mr. Oppenhauser negotiated with a company in which he held shares, right? And it was just not negotiation, it was a variation of that contract. Obviously there was a recommendation from Advocate Kassim, and it's a recommendation. So we want to know what was the decision taken by the board on that on that matter. Right? All what we know is that Mr. Kassim is still there. There is a recommendation coming from the advocate that he must be cancelled. I just want to ask the board, are you happy with that recommendation? Is the recommendation? And if the answer is yes, then would you take the same attitude where it's a junior official in the company? Is that good corporate governance? Because it means everybody else can just renegotiate with himself, and then you have got these escalations. I think we need to be, if we are to be taken into confidence as far as that is concerned. Can you share with us the OEMs involved in the construction of especially Medupe and Kusile, right? And when you do that, can you also share what was the original price? Where are we now? And I see that there are reasons that you have seen, but let's have that. Perhaps if we are just to remind the board, the fiduciary first and foremost, the fiduciary responsibility of directors is to the company. There's a slide where Eskom is bemoaning the fact that there are IPPs and they must pay for it. It's somewhere I can't remember the slide very well, but I would like to ask from the Eskom, in them taking into consideration their fiduciary responsibilities, what are they doing with that? The IPPs, we know that we are paying far above what you are paying from the other sources of electricity. What is your responsibility? Remember, I'm talking about the fiduciary responsibility of the director to the company. Is that to the best interest of Eskom? That's the question. Of the seven suppliers that we talk about, we said there's only one supplier that you have been successful with. Perhaps even before, on those suppliers, why are we not giving names of the suppliers? Why are we only having supplier one, supplier two, supplier three? Not one, that's one, but two, can you have the names of the companies that you are negotiating with and that you are saying that overcharging Eskom? Let's have those names. You know, in the spirit of transparency, yesterday we were interacting with National Treasury and people of South Africa have asked that the people who are involved in PPEs, we want to have the names of those companies published. Any reason why these suppliers, supplier one to supplier seven, we don't know the names? That's one, but two, I think as the committee would like to know which companies are negotiating. It can't be secret. It can't be secret, especially when the people of South Africa are paying those companies. You should know who are paying and why is it difficult for you to come to any conclusion about the renegotiation of this contract. In the same contract, please share with this committee and the people of South Africa, how much is the market price of coal? And how much are we paying for those with those companies? And perhaps in the same vein, you may want to say, if we're paying the market price, that's how much Eskom would have saved. But what power does Eskom have over the supply? It looks like the roles are changed, because you keep on saying it's more than a year that you have been talking about this thing. You are saying we're not being successful. Who determines the price? Perhaps this goes with the question, Jamkul. Does Eskom have the capacity to manage this contract? Can you please check? Do you have capacity to do that? Because contract management, it takes from the time you enter into a contract and you don't outsource your powers to the supplier, to the person that you pay. But here it looks like we are going to the suppliers and we are begging the suppliers to agree on the prices. So I would like you to attend to that. So let me see. I'm still fine. About the companies which have been overpaid, is there any criminal activity there? Are you if so, apart from the, apart from the SIU, have you as ESCOM gone out and reported cases to the police? We can't be waiting for SIU, it's a separate process altogether, but you should from yourselves be knowing that there's been this criminal activity. And how many of those cases have been reported to the police, not those which are being investigated by SIU. CEO, please talk about the contract which started at 114 million rand, and we learned that it's now 14 billion rand. Can you please take into this confidence, how does it happen to move from 114 million rand to 14 billion rand, the circumstances of where you'll do that? Or perhaps that's just fiction. I definitely read something about that contract. Slide 2 of 15, talking about Medup and Kusile, there's something that says that the contractors did not deliver according to expectations. What were the penalties that they paid if they didn't? If they had expectations, you have agreed, that's what you are going, when you write that contract, at all the times, they always charge us penalties. What penalties if they don't deliver according to the expectation? Say the somewhere you said a contract expertise assumed to be there, but it looks like during the process then it was discovered that that expertise was not there, and that's why we are having the delays and so on. And we are paying. If we say it was assumed, didn't they say that they have got that expertise? I think that's what they would have said. And that's why in the first instance, they were appointed because of that expertise. I don't see us appointing contractors who don't have an expertise. So if they mislead the board, for example, to start there? And if they did, what has been the consequences? What is the fallback position of ESCOM? And what have you done with that? I know that you are paying, there are some defects at Kusile and Medupi that you are dealing with and you are paying for it. Where are the companies that are responsible for those defects? I think I'll leave it I'll leave it at that allow the DM and this team and ESCOM to respond.
Yes. Chair, thank you very much. Honourable members for very clear questions. I will deal with the question of the board, what is the status of the board and the reported goings on within the board after the team would have disposed of the very operational questions in the environment. The chair can deal with some of those, but I'll talk to the question of the board as well. May so decide, you will also share some insight as the chair currently of the board. Thank you very much, Chair. Can I invite them to come?
Okay. Can I start with the board, Chair and Deputy Minister and Honourable Members? First of all, I want to make the point that there are no divisions within the board of ESCOM. I think we are quite united. We work in consultation with each other. We debate issues. And as far as I'm aware, there has been no divisions whatsoever. That occasionally we may differ on a point of view does not imply divisions. It's just part of a debating process and trying to refine each other's ideas. However, there is a persistent issue which the Deputy Minister may want to address later on. The board of ESCOM is now deficient with 6 members that have left the board. 6. So we are actually in short supply of the appropriate number of board members that we should have at ESCOM. We have tried to appeal, I think, to the minister and the department, I think, to fill these positions. And obviously, there are other processes that they are following, and maybe they can give us an update on that. I'm aware that the president and the minister have often said that they want to restructure the board, they want to complement the board or beef up the board. This has not happened, and this is obviously causing a lot of overload on the board. So we require to be beefed up, but as a board at the moment, I think we are quite united. The second issue I want to deal with is the issue of the Econ Oil matter. This is obviously under legal constraints, but what the board of ESCOM does is it looks at contracts. It doesn't look at who has applied for the contract. So we don't racialize contracts when they come to ESCOM. We simply look at the quality, the values, the ethics, and the processes that have been followed. And that's all that, and the evidence that is available to support us. So we are not going to say that because there are African women or there are Indian women, that's how we look at the contracts that have been applied to ESCOM. We look at the contract itself and look at the quality and the processes and the systems that have been applied, I think, to that contract. And that's how we ultimately judge them. So I want to again appeal that race is not the issue. Empowerment is not the issue. It is the systems and the processes and the legality and the lawfulness of those contracts that the board looks at through its committees. That applies to any other contract, including the Econ one that is, as I say, under legal constraints at the moment. The third issue I want to deal with is this matter of quotation that I said that parliamentarians don't know anything about ESCOM. I must confess that that is out of character. I don't think I could ever say that. I suspect that the honorable member must provide me the right quotation. It's very difficult to interpret somebody what somebody says. I think I seem to recall that I said yes.
Prof. People want to see the prof. Please, your video on.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Chair. I just wanted to say that this sounded to me like it's out of character. What I would have said was that there is more that is happening at ESCOM inside and internally than what I think people outside often see. That's really, I think, what I conveyed. Not that parliamentarians know nothing about ESCOM. I could never say that. It's just out of character. So I would appreciate it if I could get where this quotation came from in the manner that has been articulated today. In terms of the COO matter, the one that the chair addressed about the sanctions, I think as the board, we have been debating this issue for a very long time. There have been two senior counsels that have investigated this matter and have absolutely found nothing against Mr. Jan Oberholzer. In fact, I think he has gone out of his way to defend ESCOM even against those people that it is claimed that he had conflicts of interest with. He has declared his conflicts of interest, and I want to say this categorically, as a board, we have really not found anything that Mr. Oberholzer has done. And it's very difficult to understand where this noise is coming from. We have had, as I say, three senior counsels have investigated the matter, have found nothing. As a board, I think we are busy finalizing our own, I think, decisions with regard to this matter. And I want to again share with you in confidence, we have found nothing that Mr. Oberholzer has done that deserves, I think, the amount of noise and the amount of persecution that he is undergoing at the moment. So those are the issues that I wanted to address, but I want to emphasize the thing that I think maybe honorable members should take is that as a board, we are constrained by the numbers and we require to be beefed up. But as a board, I think we are united and I think we are trying to do the best that we can. We respect, I think, what the chair spoke about fiduciary responsibilities. And we are always reminded of those, I think, when we take decisions and
within the board meeting. I think I'll leave it at that, and maybe the deputy minister can supplement some of the issues I've left in relation to the board, but those would be my answers. Thank you.
It's your team, it's your team, Prof. It's your team, we are listening to you.
I'll ask the GCE to take the rest of the questions that are operational, because we want to distinguish between oversight and operational issues. Thank you. GCE, Mr. Andre de Reiter.
Thank you very much, Prof. Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members, for the questions that were asked. We appreciate the oversight role that you conduct, and we certainly appreciate the scrutiny that you put us under. Honourable Chair, if I may ask, first of all, and I'm trying to group the questions together by subject matter just to make it more efficient, if I can ask Ms. Elsie Poulet to please respond to questions relating to the age profile as well as the race breakdowns for senior level appointments, particularly senior level appointments that have recently been made at EXCO level, and then at the same time also deal with the issue of artisans, internships, and the question around the 4,085 other employees. Elsie, if I can ask you to please handle those questions.
Thank you, and through you, Chair, I missed the question on the age profile. I'll tackle all of them and I'll handle it later once I get clarity. Just to provide a breakdown of the 33% female employees at Eskom, that number translates into about 13,000 of our total complements are female. In terms of the percentages around the occupational levels, as semi-skilled, we've got 26%. That translates into about 2,800. We've got skilled at 35%. That translates into just under 8,000. We've got 39% professional. That translates into 2,500. And we've got 40% senior management. That translates into 159. And then we have got 15% at top management. If I link that to the recent EXCO appointments, Chair, we are 95% at concluding the top structure since the appointment of the Group Chief Executive. We have appointed about five black professionals at EXCO. By the end of October, we would have filled all the positions with EXCO in terms of the appointments, and we would have also increased at top management with a black female by end of October. And that also leads to the question around succession planning. Given the fact that we have not had stability for so long, once we have finalized these appointments by end of October, we will then be able to follow our internally recognized succession management program to ensure that we also have got sufficient resources to fill when attrition happens. If I go to the issue around slide 39 on the number of artisans and so on, what you'd notice, Chair and the committee, in terms of that is that what we use in terms of the naming conventions, for example, let me use the engineering question, that it looks like the number of engineers has reduced. So the slide will show a reduction in terms of people who are practicing as engineers in the organization, but our overall number of engineers has not reduced, because what you also find, you find that you've got qualified engineers who have moved into managerial positions. So the overall number of engineers at ESCOM is much higher than what you see. What you see here in terms of our system are those people who today are practicing as engineers. The issue of artisans have also been raised in terms of the number. If you look
at the on slide 39, you will see categories of operator, artisan, utility men, controllers. That's all in the categories of your level of work in the organization, which is key to the organization. So in that grouping, you're going to find a lot of them might have been trained as artisans, but the way we deploy them, we either appoint them as operators in generation, we either appoint them as controllers and officials in distributions and so on. So that number, if you look at our strategic workforce plan, we are not concerned about the drop because it's also linked to our supply and demand for the next 10 years. The question around learner, the learner pipeline, we currently have got 1,517 learners, 871 are artisans, 465 are engineers, 52 are operators, 61 are technicians, and 68 are non-technicians. So that is also informed by our strategic workforce plan in terms of the demand and supply of our resources. Andra, I don't know if you'd like me to address the issue around the remuneration standards too. I'll tackle that if you're okay with that.
Yes, please, Elsie.
Okay, so if you look at the issue around the remuneration standards, from our side, we have partially complied. We have submitted our recommendations in terms to the shareholder. What we have also done in the interim before that is being finalized, we have ensured that since this commitment, no performance bonuses were paid for the top officials. We have also stopped the long-term incentive scheme for the top officials, and we have not even paid the performance bonuses to the rest of the organization in the last two financial years. So I think I've covered all of them except the issue of the age profile, which I missed, Chair.
Honourable Chair, through you, if I may proceed with allocating more questions to my Eskom colleagues, please.
CEO, I want you to come back to me when you say you have dealt with everything. So I'm off now. We are in your hands.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Caleb, if I can ask you please to deal with the questions around revenue as well as issues around the internal audit on overpayment and the process that we've got in terms of three-way matching to ensure that we have control measures in place to prevent overpayments, then please also comment on cost savings, the NERSA deduction, and the age analysis of overpayment. And I think those were the finance questions. Caleb, please.
Yeah, thank you, Andre. Honourable members, I think firstly the question around revenue and the impact of COVID in terms of Eskom financials for this financial year. Honourable member Langwini, it has about a 10 billion rand lower revenue impact in terms of volume multiplied by the price of electricity. How Eskom is dealing with this change in this financial year is linked to what the GCE has said. We need to deliver savings of 14 billion for FY21. We're on track to deliver that. And as I've highlighted earlier, the one lever we also look at is trying to reduce our capital expenditure to around the 20 billion level so that we can meet our cash flow requirements. And we've made it very clear that there's no further support from government over and above what is already on the card in terms of the appropriations. Eskom needs to live within its means. I think the honourable members, it's very important that one appreciates that the finances are also directly impacted by our operational performance, and
Then, members, in terms of the NASA decision, yes, correctly. So we're now in the process of an appeal, and we will go through that. But from our understanding is that it will take time. It does mean that at a future price determination, there should be price adjustments to recover the 69 billion rand around the appropriations which were deducted by NASA in MYPD4. If I didn't touch on some of the other questions, the one around the overpayments and the controls, honorable members, yes, we make use of the three-way matching, but I think you've correctly highlighted that it's fine and it does serve, and we still use it, and it's audited through our SAP system. But if someone falsifies an invoice and doubles that, I think that's where, one, you would require whistleblowing to assist you, and two, in terms of the contract management, we need to do more detail around the adjustments from the original contract, and that's what we'll focus on to try to address and flag potential overpayments in the future. Honorable member asked the question, is the cash flows, although it's draft and it's not audited? Yes, cash flows, we don't see that changing by the finalization of the audit. If there's any audit adjustments, it will probably be non-cash related adjustments. And then I think the member also talked about the impact of IPP and Eskom losing out sales to IPPs, what it means in terms of our cost base. Honorable members, I think that's where we are dealing with it from a savings perspective, but understanding that currently through the tariff, Eskom does recover the IPP cost through the MYPD methodology. And maybe let me just add and close out the whole question around the EFC disposal and the delay. Chair, the two main reasons for that was Eskom had to complete its governance process to get the approval to start the tender process. It did go out at the beginning of the year. However, due to COVID, we had to extend it. That process was closed in July, and we're currently evaluating the bids around the EFC disposal. Thank you, Andre.
Thank you very much, Caleb. Can you maybe just also deal with the matter of bad debt from business and what we're doing to cover the bad debt? Thank you.
Yes, so for this financial year, around large customers, so there was 539 million rand worth of bad debts, and this is attributable to companies that have gone into business rescue. When it gets to industrial customers, Eskom does issue letters of requesting payment, and we do have the action to then switch them off in terms of non-payment. Andre, thanks.
Thank you very much, Caleb. I'm going to ask Avin Maharaj to deal with the questions around further breakdown of the 180 million overpayment and also internal processes that are in place to prevent further overpayments from taking place, particularly from a Kusile project management perspective. And then Avin, if you can also deal with the contractors that are currently operating and to what extent we exercise control over their compliance. I would appreciate if you could handle those questions. Thank you.
From Andre. Honorable Chairman, I'll deal with the questions as raised by members. Honorable Dlamini, specific with respect to the overpayments around the 180 million, that deals with contractors that we've engaged for security, provision of security on site, some of the catering services that we've engaged on site, number of our corporate social investment program spend. So in terms of that 180 million, it's a collection of those particular work areas, security, catering, and the CSI. They are with our audit and forensic department, and from a project perspective, we are dependent on them finalizing their investigation, and then as management, we take the actions thereafter. Specific to the project, Chairman, you asked a question around the laying of police or charges at police stations. From a project perspective, for issues pertaining to site, we have laid charges for various issues, but with these specific investigations, that is how handled through Eskom's legal departments. In terms of process enhancements, as Honorable Dlamini raised, apart from the three-way matching, additional changes have been made with respect to how changes to contracts are dealt with, whether they are claims, variation orders, or compensation events. And we've implemented cross-functional teams with made up of people not from only within the project. So we've brought in other Eskom resources, but from outside of the project to maintain that neutrality around issues that are raised. So we use cross-functional teams in terms of processing of any changes that are required once a contract is underway. Chairman, also in terms of Honorable Mustafa asked about recoveries, the intention is that we are pursuing the recovery of any malfeasance wherever possible, and through the SIU, they've confirmed that they are engaging with the assets forfeiture units in terms of these recoveries for these overpayments. The Honourable Sheikh,
CEO, can I grab your own?
Yes, Honourable Chair.
Please take your video on. Yeah. Thank you. Proceed. Honourable members and Team Eskom, when you respond, please make sure that your videos are on. The technical people are phoning me. Get it from them. Please let's just remind each other that let's do that. Not unless you have got the connectivity problem that will understand. Please proceed, CEO.
Understood, Chair. I will try my video, and if it does fail, then I will switch it off. I was going to address the question about the original costs for Kusile and Medupi. In the report that we've provided to the committee, on page 78, we illustrate and show the progression of the projects in terms of the approved business cases from inception to the current approval. And I would like to repeat from a Kusile and Medupi perspective, the current approved budget costs that were approved back in 2015 have not changed. They are 161 and 156 billion rand, respectively. Honorable Chairman, in terms of the age analysis, the steps and the length of the processes, I undertake to engage with the SIU to get those processes detailed so that they can actually be shared with the committee going forward. Honorable Peters requested a list of the names of the companies that have been engaged for both Medupi and Kusile. In the report that we've provided from page 85 all the way to page 88, we've provided the listing of all of the companies engaged for both Medupi and Kusile, also illustrating the contract values at the start of the respective contracts and as to where they are currently as well. To date, at Kusile, we've engaged just on 51 individual companies for its full execution. the DUP, the figure is 37 contractors that have been engaged for the execution of the project. In terms of contractual remedies that we've exercised, one of the learnings has been the limitations in terms of our contract, but we've exercised them to the maximum. In terms of delay damages, which we are entitled to actually recover, both at Medupi and Kusile, these delay damages have been recovered in excess of R1 billion per project. There are different values per contract that we have recovered in terms of the delays caused by the individual contractors. Eskom also has a right in terms of counterclaims to the contractors, and we're exercising these to the maximum allowed per individual contractor, chairman. Currently at Medupi, our counterclaims, of course, 2.5 claims, exceed well over between 2.2 and 2.3 billion rand per project. So in terms of us exercising our contractual remedies for non-performance by contractors that we've engaged with. John, I think I've addressed those questions that you directed towards me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Avin. Let us now move to matters related to procurement. Solly, if I can please ask you to deal with the demographics of our contractors and also look at the assistance that we provide to SMMEs in terms of enabling them to obtain business from Eskom. Solly? Sorry, you may be on mute.
Thanks, Che. Can you hear me, Che?
Yes, we can. Please proceed.
Okay, thanks, Andre. I will deal with the questions you raised and the other questions relating to that one. I will start with the 39 companies that you indicated that they were red flagged. The question was how they were identified. In the slide, we indicated that we requested our data experts to look at the subsystem, and there were two thresholds that we have used. The first one was we looked at all companies that were above 1 billion that are open contracts, and we also looked at the abnormal movement, which was 200% and above. And that selection from the system gave us a list of 39 companies. But however, we could not confirm whether there are any irregularities in those movements. That's why we referred that matter to a forensic for them to be able to verify. And as soon as we have the outcome, the report will be given to the committee. We, however, did not look at all the contracts because we have so many contracts in ECO. Measures put in place to deal with the empowerment of companies. With the promulgation of the 2017 Preferential Procurement Regulations, ESCOM, we are complying with that regulations, and those regulations are able to assist all organs of trade to empower the previously disadvantaged through subcontracting, and if they contracts are more than 30%, we prescribe those subcontracting, and the subcontracting will go to different designated groups, which we can provide information later if it's also required. We have also, through that regulation, are able to pre-qualify a level of company. We can issue a tender and say a level one, level two will only participate. And when you do that, you will empower most of those companies that are previously disadvantaged. In our slide, we did not indicate the youth companies that are getting, the women companies that are getting tenders. That information, I don't have it now, but we will provide it when we go back to the offices. It will be provided to members. Then there was an issue of the contracts that are more than 20 years. Even that information, we don't have it readily available. We'll look at our system, and we will provide the list of those contracts that may have been in existence from 1994 to now. There was a question which will also affect then on the other side of the reviewing of contracts. The general contracts that are national contracts excluding coal, it was Ofcom officials that were reviewing them and negotiating. We did not employ consultants to do that. Thanks, Andre.
Thank you, Solly. I'm now going to ask Dan to please deal with the issue of procurement of coal on long-term contracts, potentially dating back prior to 1994. Dan, if you could also deal, and this was a question raised by both the Honourable Sheikh Imam as well as the Honourable Peters, and then Dan, if you could also share with the committee the names of suppliers of contracts, I think also refer to the estimated duration and the remaining energy that is still required to be supplied under those contracts. And then lastly, also address from your side the capability of Eskom to negotiate contracts. Dan, please.
Okay, thank you. Let me start with the names. I mean, the companies are the seven companies, and in the order of how we've basically indexed them in the submission are Glencore, Mwelase, Arishumeng, Mbuyelo, Universal, African Royalty, and Zimkulu Mining. And similar to supply chain management, the whole evaluation and review and the building of the model, we've done it internally using our mining engineers, geologists, and our accountants.
Hello.
Hello.
My apologies.
Yes.
I just wanted to interrupt you. Can you slowly speak to the name of the companies? We are too fast.
Oh, my apologies, Honorable Chair.
Yeah.
The first one is Glencore, followed by Mwelase, then Arishumeng, Mbuyelo Group, Universal Co., African Royalty, and Zimkulu Mining.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. And similarly to what my colleagues mentioned earlier, I think that's the part I was busy trying to give feedback, is that we do the analysis, you know, like ourselves. Firstly, we build the model. for cost evaluation of the different mines, and then we come up with a negotiating strategy, and then we negotiate ourselves. So everything is done internally, you know, like in Eskom. No consultants, you know, like were used. We however, I mean, use a lot of, you know, like tools from the industry, the same tools that the mining industry is using. We use, you know, like other inputs from other consulting houses on some of the, you know, like a market intelligence and business intelligence. So we do that quite a lot. We do collaborate with a number of, you know, like consulting companies. But the actual work is done, you know, like internally within Eskom. And Chair, the number of coal suppliers which may predate 1994 or long term, I think to make things simpler, we would I think it would be easier to add them to the list that solely will compile, because it deals with all, you know, like contracts in Eskom. But it is predominantly, you know, like the contracts where the mine and the power stations were basically attached. So, and the mantra was, you know, like they would first go on open tender, identify the source of coal, and then they would build the power station at the mouth of that mine, so that you don't transport coal, you only transport electricity. It's cheaper to transport electricity than coal, and basically use a conveyor to basically join the mine and the power station, and you design the power station based on that particular coal field, so you can have consistent supply. So all our cost plus mines, there's only five of them remaining, Chair, are basically contracts that were concluded before, you know, like in 1994. They all predate 1994, and they have also start coming to maturity, that is reaching 40 years. And then we have on the fixed price contract, it's two of them, you know, like the one supplying Matimba and the one supplying Duva. The cost plus are the suppliers tied to Letabo, you know, a power station, to Tuka power station, Krill power station, Mata power station, and Kenda. So those have, you know, those long-term cost plus contracts. So those are the only, you know, like a seven, you know, like a pre 1994, you know, like a contract. I think post 1994, the only, you know, like a contract longer than 20 years is basically the Medupi contract, which was concluded in 2008. Most of our medium and short-term contracts, they range from a very short-term contract of about a month to a contract as long as 15, you know, like 14 years. That's the realm that we are in, but we can certainly provide the other information on the seven that I've made on the submission. And if we may be allowed, Chair, in that submission, we will also provide the details on these seven suppliers we were negotiating with, you know, like to show where our, you know, like a pricing point, you know, like is, that is based on our analysis and the price of that particular contract, you know, like show the percentage and the rent value, you know, like that information there. We just have to, you know, like collate it in a manner, you know, like that the question has been, you know, like posed to us, because that was a trigger, you know, like for those suppliers who were making in excess of about 25% profit margin, which is typically what you'll find in this capital intensive, you know, like a mining industry. Okay. Just want to refer back to my notes to deal with the other, you know, like questions from the other suppliers. Yeah, and I think the long-term contracts, which I take it that's what is meant by evergreen contract. Chair, as I mentioned, how, you know, like there was never a power station historically in Eskom which was built without a tight colliery. So the power station, you know, like it was built with the tight colliery, and it's a consistent approach globally when you build huge, you know, like a power stations, or what we call them six packs, you know, like that you would have it, you know, like at the mouth, you know, like of the mine. But the development of that particular colliery is also capital intensive. If you look at, you know, the Medupi expansion and how much Exxaro, you know, like spent, you know, like to expand Grootegeluk colliery, and I mean it's in their financial reports and so on. I think they spent in excess of 10 billion rands. So if you want, you know, like a consistent supply, high volume, consistent quality, chip via conveyor, you know, it requires a large colliery, and to recover the capital cost of the colliery is quite similar to Eskom. You know, you'd need more time to amortize it over the life, you know, like of the power station, which makes your cash, you know, cash flows much more smoother and net, you know, like a cheaper, you know, coal. That's basically how these contracts, you know, like a chair, were concluded, you know, like they were historically 40-year contracts. And as we said, mentioned, we will give the details on those that were concluded pre-94 and even the ones that are that came after, you know, like in 1994. But that's the basis on which these contracts, you know, were concluded, because the assets are also very capital intensive. Yeah. And when you start talking a mine in excess of 5 million tons per annum, we definitely talk about a huge colliery, yeah, which requires big funding. Okay. Then there was a question on the pricing. Who determines the pricing? Chair, in South Africa, there is no domestic market similar to the export market. So in Eskom, all our coal contracts, we conclude them through the tendering process, which is prescribed by PPPFA. And the contracts are negotiated, and the Eskom preferred pricing model is the one where, you know, like you look at efficient cost of a miner and a fair return, you know, like otherwise people would not invest, you know, like a large sums of capital to establish mines. And that's basically, you know, like and we certainly do not prefer to have our coal costed using the export, you know, like price, which is always, you know, like a significantly higher, you know, like for the same quality, you know, like of coal. So our contracts are bespoke, and the pricing arrangement is on a one-on-one basis with the supplier based on, you know, like the type of colliery, you know, like is it open cast underground, how deep is the colliery, what is the quality, does the coal require, you know, like a washing and so on, where do we need the coal and so on. That's the basis, you know, like on which, you know, like the price. So it is ultimately a negotiated, you know, like a price. And to link up to the question is that what we saw happening, unfortunately, in 2008 is that all the procurement activities that preceded 2018 did not yield desired results in the number of contracts that could have been concluded. And we started, you know, like a burning coal off our strategic stockpiles. And when we lost, you know, like three mines due to business rescue in February 2018, you know, like we had to rob Peter and give Paul from the contracted coal, which wasn't the rate at which, you know, like our coal stocks were depleting, and pushed us, you know, to embark on an emergency procurement, you know, like late in November, you know, like the same year. And to the effect that, Chair, when we provide the information that some of these high-priced contracts are people that in as far back as 2017, you know, like we push back, you know, like because of the pricing, until we had very few options of people who could supply coal, you know, like ready to Eskom and large volumes. And that's how we ended up, you know, like as mentioned in our submission document of what happened in 2018. And Chair, I think your questions, I think we've dealt with the name of the supplier. The capacity, Chair, we believe, you know, like there is capacity in Eskom, you know, like and where necessary, we also do use, you know, like consultants, especially for market research and other things. And then the market price, I've explained, you know, like the question that there is no domestic, you know, like a market price. People always use reference to the export, you know, like index, that is the API for pricing via, you know, like a Richards Bay to determine what would be, you know, like the parity price in Mpumalanga at the mine gate. Thanks, Andre. I think I've covered the all the core questions. Yeah.
CEO?
Yes, thank you, Honorable Chair. If I may deal with the remaining questions that have not been addressed by my colleagues. The Honourable Joseph asked if Eskom is free of state capture and corruption. I think we are still dealing with a number of legacy issues, so we are addressing those. We are cleaning up. We will not rid ourselves of state capture and corruption overnight, but we are certainly trying our best to address that. When it comes to Minister grant us tariffs that are reflective of poor costs. In terms of the electricity price comparison, there was from Honourable Kwankwa to do a detailed analysis. We can certainly do that. And we can then benchmark and determine what the relative pricing structure of South African electricity is. The question whether or not Eskom should play in renewables, I certainly believe that Eskom has a role to play in renewables. We have recently issued a request for expressions of interest to the market to assist us with developing strategies for repurposing balance lines, and one of the potential options there is to install renewables.
Andre, I can see you are being affected. Connectivity, you may switch off your video.
I hope that's better. In terms of the Honourable Peter's question around the progress with WASA, we have made progress there with a pilot project in Soweto. Unfortunately, we were interdicted by one household, and that delayed the process. That has now been resolved. We are now 70% advanced with that project. I certainly agree with the Honourable Peters that it would be an excellent idea for selected local content to be applied to the manufacturing of renewable energy components, and we would I think seek to emulate some of the very successful policies followed, for example, for the motor industry's development program. And this, however, is a policy matter, and we would therefore leave it to government to assist us in that regard. But from our perspective, we would definitely seek to support that. Lastly, Honourable Chair, in terms of the IPP cost, we are engaging through the DMRE and the IPP office with a view to renegotiate the financing for, in particular, bid window 1 and 2 in order to reduce the cost. The financing cost at the time for bid window 1 and 2 was quite high because of an uncertainty regarding the maturity of the technology and also uncertainty regarding the market, and those have now been resolved. Lastly, Honourable Chair, the escalation in the contract that you referred to from 114 million to 14 billion, this is the so-called Black and Veatch contract. We have done a provisional forensic report on that. We have identified as potential irregular expenditure an amount of 12.7 billion. We will now be embarking on a full forensic investigation to determine exactly if there was any unlawfulness involved in that irregular expenditure that took place between the period of 2009 up until so that is work in progress, and we are going to be investigating that, Chair, and we will then report back to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. DM?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm listening,
no.
Chair.
No, DM, I was saying if you want to wait, because there's something that I just want to do, and perhaps you may just come in once so that you can see.
Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, here is the response coming from Team Eskom. I'll allow you 2 minutes if there's a follow-up that you want to make. We have negotiated with Parliament. They've given us some more time. So it's a rare opportunity where we interact with Eskom. So if you have got any follow-up that you want to make, and as I'm saying, I'll be very strict, 2 minutes. Who wants to start? them. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Just
sorry.
Just wait. Just wait. Next.
Matafan.
Matafan. Next.
Pankwa, Chair.
Pankwa.
Ntangweni, Chair.
Ntangweni. Unmute, you're muted. Okay. So it's Peter. Okay. That. So here's my view.
Chairperson.
Phone.
Chairperson Mlenzana here. I beg not to make a follow-up because I've just rejoined. If you can allow me the first arrangement that I made, that I will write my questions and email them for a written response.
No, but I think you'll be the first one. You must come in with your, even with your original question, if that's fine with you. Even now, I know you are struggling to come in.
Yes, you bear with me then if some questions were asked. First one would be going to the deputy minister.
Just wait. Just wait.
Okay.
So I'm having Oral Mlenzana, Joseph Matafa, Kwankwan, Tangwini, Peters. Anybody else? And that's who? Please mute members. Please mute. Mute as a please. Okay, that's fine, Oral members. I'll start with Oral Mlenzana. Oral Mlenzana, I was giving other.
The first one to the Deputy Minister on challenges relating to the person power and transition within ESCOM. If we can be brief as to how far is the CRO's report? Because we haven't met the CRO. Then the second one would be by October, we were told that ESCOM had a challenge with a lot of unpayments, which were ranging at above 36 million. What is the state of affairs now? Then the last one, Chair, the very, very last one, would be, fortunately, I had the response which responds to this question of the coal suppliers. And now, if then there is actually no determinant in terms of prices, where else can ESCOM verify their prices? And also, what is the relationship between the suppliers and ESCOM? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Joseph. Honorable Joseph.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to know as a follow up if there are any positive or negative results relating to the recovery of money. In other words, I would like to know if there are any contracts or recovery of money projects that is concluded, whether it was positive or negative outcomes, but that is concluded and that we put it behind us, if ESCOM have that information. Because a lot of the things are ongoing, but what is concluded that we can absolutely say we put it behind us and we can do a tick box on that and move on. Then I would like to know the housing subsidy scheme. I accept there must be benefits to staff. The subsidy, and I'm talking about cost now. What is the percentage that they give? The percentage that they give the loan to staff? What is the budget? What is the budget annually to provide housing subsidy schemes? And what is the percentage? And then the last point, I will do a follow-up question on this. Last year I asked questions about electricity supply to our neighboring country. like to know if there is payment from these countries, outstanding payments, and if there, if but I'll do the follow-up questions on the contract itself, as to what Eskom is struggling with. Does it affect any neighboring countries' governments as well, in terms of supplying electricity? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Orma Tafa.
Thank you very much, Chair. Now, mine is very brief, Chair. Actually, I'll take a few seconds. It's on the compliance with the special appropriations conditions. And I think maybe on this one, the DM might be in the best position to assist. Out of the four conditions that the DPE had to ensure compliance with, only two have been achieved. And I'm writing on this one, Chair, because in one of our engagements with ESCOM, they indicated that they do not feel the role of oversight from the DPE. You'd remember that we even raised on it to say in an indictment of the legislature where an entity is saying that we are not properly managed as far as oversight is concerned. So my question would be, how then would the ensure compliance with all those conditions that have been attached to the special appropriations bill, particularly those that actually are situated in the purview of the DPE? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Nkwankwa.
Chair, thank you very much. I think on the Honorable, I've been covered on the question about electricity supply to neighboring countries. There's a specific question. I think I was probably I was not clear when I spoke about age analysis when it comes to the overpayment of suppliers. If there's a report out that there exists of this issue, you'll pardon me, Chair. But I want to make an example. When you work in the bank, if your account is overdrawn, there would be a detailed report about when did the incidence of overdrawing the account occur, who was responsible for it, what interventions have been taken to try and address that or address the situation. It's that kind of report detailed with interventions and say how far is the process, but done for each and every single one of those overpayments. To say, for an example, you have, this company was overpaid for the first time in 2017 with 200 million rands. What did we do? When did we pick it up? How did we allow other overpayments to occur? If there are a series of payments that took place over the period, all of those things to say, what were the weaknesses in the control measures, right? Then you are able to pick up who was responsible for it and hold those people accountable so that we can see that it's not just the companies that we're dealing with where we're trying to recoup money, but the officials responsible for it are also held to account. And that we're able every time ESCOM appears before the committee to keep track of the progress of each and every one of those transactions. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Sangwini, and after that, Honorable Peters. I'm starting to experience connectivity problems. So immediately, Honorable Sangwini finishes. Honorable Peters, please come in.
Thank you, Chair, and I agree with Kwankwa because I was also not sufficiently answered based on the strengthening the internal process capacity of ESCOM, Chair. And I want to shoot straight to the compliance issues yet again, Chair, and the conditions put before ESCOM. Why are they not adhering to the compliance of National Treasury on the conditions that was put in front of them? And then also, Chair, on the remuneration standards that is still awaiting, and there the Deputy Minister can maybe, or the DG can maybe assist us with, the remuneration policy as to when will that be finalized, Chair. Thank you very much.
Peter?
Chairperson, I think I'm also not sufficiently covered in the response to the question related to which companies from the companies that were overpaid also featured in the Competition Commission's construction corruption scandal. I have not heard a response that tells me that there has been an evaluation or a scrutiny by ESCOM on the response related to the seven suppliers. My issue is, why did the renegotiation of contracts go to this seven particularly? But also my concern, Chairperson, is that this seven is actually small fry. It's not a big company. And that's why I wanted to know, why is the big companies not considered for, especially those who are in the diesel and gas, as well as in the coal space, who to renegotiate this contract with them? But also, I have not heard a reply to why the reduction in the number of engineers. Eskom is an engineering intense company, and my worry is, since 2013, the number of engineers has drastically reduced. So it means when an engineer retires or resigns or dies, they are not replaced. So that for me is a concern, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Peter. I think it's me. Let me start this. Can you just share again with us the escalations that Medupi and Busile, the initial budget, where are we now, and where do we hope by the time we finish, where are we going to be? I think that let's have that so that I'm not very clear. And related to that, oral members, we can't have such big overruns and nobody has been held responsible for those overruns. No company has been held responsible for those overruns. I heard of a 2 billion rand, 2.5 billion rand plus minus, which has been recovered. It's nothing in the bigger scheme of things. We're talking about billions here. I think the last time we spoke about this, it was about 150 billion rand overrun. But that's why I would like Eskom to just tell us exactly how big is the overrun now and what is the estimated cost. This thing, it doesn't feel like somebody has been or a company has been held responsible for this. I would like to hear what Eskom has to say about this. The chairperson of Eskom says when we're talking about Econ Oil, we don't racialize contract. I don't know what exactly that means, because one may read in that statement that empowerment, make economic empowerment, which has a lot to do with race because of our past, which we are trying to. Do I hear you very well when you say you don't racialize, you don't look at the race when you deal with contracts? How do you deal with a black economic empowerment then if you don't look at the race of this contract? I think we need, I think we're going to interact, and DM, we need to get closer to this thing. We want to see the role of Eskom. One, what are they doing as far as broad-based black empowerment? They can't deal with this matter as if they're a private company which is being pushed and so on. And I think the department, if the department will get closer to this, in terms of deracialization, they've got big budgets, and we as government are also giving them a lot of money. So we want to see their strategies come as far as that's concerned. This is also related to what Honorable Peter has raised. What is the role of Eskom as far as localization is concerned all around? And again, we'd like to see when it comes to the professionals, are they used in their budget? What is it that goes to black professionals in general? I think that's the engagement, and we'd like the department to get closer to that, because we're going to interact on that big time. We'd like to see the role of Eskom, and we're doing that with all the other SOCs that we interact with, and even with the department. Because the question of reigniting the economy of this country and deracializing the economy of this country is not only a government's responsibility or one department's responsibility. It's our collective responsibility. And I would like a DM that you really get closer to that, because we are going to be really calling you back and would like this, what was given to us, it's something that I usually get from the companies where they tick box and say they were dealt with this thing. It doesn't feel like a company which is owned by government. It doesn't feel like a company which goes to parliament and asks for recapitalization and bailout. So we need more interaction interaction around that, and the board, this should be a board issue. Now, we were told as to how these, we asked about what is the market price of coal, and the response was all those negotiations and so on. Can we get the average market price, factoring all those things into consideration? Because I'm sure you wouldn't have one company, you are paying, let's say, 400 rand per ton, and the other one, you are paying 1,500 rand per ton, and then you find an excuse for that. So can you please have an average price of that, factoring all these things that were alluded to? And then I would like, I think it's again on the broad-based vertical empowerment. Have this type of a contract been awarded to a black company? Where, for instance, you go, we're definitely taken into account to how you get into the price, where they end up having to establish a mine and so on. Can we also share with us, is there a black company or a company from any of the designated group which has enjoyed what is being provided to this type of company? Chair, honorable members, I want to come back to the professor. I think you were saying about two or three senior counsels that have been used to deal with this matter, and the board has come to the conclusion that there's nothing wrong about this. I would like to hear the chair again on this matter. Is it true that Mr. Opel, okay, let me also take the fact that he declared his interest. There is no personal vendetta from any of us here. It's something which is out there and people have raised it. But I want to check. One, I think what is coming out very clear is that Mr. Opelhauser declared the interest. Having declared interest, now, was he involved in the negotiation of the escalation of prices with stock and stock? I think that's a... If he was involved, is that not a conflict of interest? The fact that you have declared interest doesn't mean that you can do anything. My understanding of that, if he had declared that interest, when that matter came up, he would have excused himself from this negotiation, because it's like negotiating with yourself. So I want to get from the board, is the board saying that no, there was nothing wrong about Mr. Opelhauser in him being involved in the negotiation with a company where he has got shares? I don't take an issue about him declaring an interest, but my understanding of declaring interest is that when you declare interest and then there's something which comes in front of you where you are conflicted, you excuse yourself. But is the board saying no, that's fine? So it means everybody ESCOM can get into that thing and negotiate, and the board won't be able to hold anybody responsible. I would like to hear you, Chair, and DM, if you don't mind, you may also come in on that. Yeah, I think let's allow you at DM and team ESCOM, and if you can be latest, please take us to quarter two.
Thank you, Chair. Can I ask the Prof to kick off first, and then the Group Chief Executive, and then I'll wrap up. Still attend to the issues that have been referred my way.
Yeah.
Can you come in, Prof?
Thank you, Chair. Let me be visible again.
Yeah. Just a second, Prof. While you are becoming visible, just hold, there's one matter I forgot to to address. The professor raised a matter which was one honourable member raised about how, as far as concerned, he came out on the question of the members, the MPs knowing or not knowing what is happening. And I think the professor has explained himself as far as that is concerned. And I would ask the honourable members or honourable member to accept the professor's explanation. We've got no reason, but obvious when there's communication, there's a communicator and the recipient. If that's how it came up, and this has been explained, and I think let's take it as a matter that has been dealt with, and the explanation is accepted. Prof, please come in.
Thank you. I will ask Professor Mungalo to deal with the legal issue in relation to the declaration of interest of Mr. Oberholzer. But I just want to state a few things. First of all, I think I spoke about that we don't racialize contracts. And what I mean is that in a country like South Africa, we accept that there is a BEE law or a proclamation. Everybody in a company like Eskom has policies around BEE. And in the process of evaluating every contract, that kicks in during the evaluation and assessment of a contract. When it comes to the board, it is the highest level at which I think we have to ensure that that contract is beyond reproach. And we deal with it in terms of the systems and the processes of evaluation without having to regress to the level of where it comes from. That's the first component. The second component says that there is no law in the Constitution that says black people can just do unlawful things and they will be forgiven because they are black people. There is no such a thing in our Constitution. So we have to evaluate every contract in terms of its legality and in the manner in which it was evaluated within the Constitution and within the law of the country. That's what I was meaning about the racialization or the de-racialization of the way we look at contracts as the board. I will then ask, I think, Mr. De Reiter and Professor Mungalo, I think, to deal with the issue of the conflicts of interest that has been raised by the chair. Professor Mungalo or Andre?
Thank you, Chair. Maybe what I need to do is to start first by extending my greetings to the honorable members and also members of the committee and the deputy minister. I am the member of the People and Governance Committee and also the chair of the People and Governance Committee. First, in answering the question as to whether the conflict of interest that involved execution of the documents relating to the modification of the contracts involving the company in which the COO had a conflict of interest, I must point out that Eskom's policy is now aligned to the Companies Act, particularly Section 75, which requires that in making a decision, any board committee or board should avoid any member actually making a decision or being part of the decision making when they are conflicted. The best they can do is to just declare and then leave the meeting. But our investigation has actually shown that Mr. Oberholzer signed off on a submission to ESCO's tender committee on the 11th of December 2019. And furthermore, on the 27th of January 2020, he signed off on a submission to the Investment and Finance Committee. Now, in line with the decision-making process at ESCOM, this decision on modification was actually the decision of the IFC. IFC is a board, committee. It is not an executive committee. The matter was finally had to be decided by the board committee. Now, when Mr. Oberholzer appeared in the board committee, IFC, he was appearing on the basis that he had actually signed on the submission in line with what the presentations are made by the committee members, by the executive officials before the committee, but he was not responsible and he was not part and parcel of the decision making when it comes to the modification. And in fact, the modification was supposed to be approved by IFC, of which Mr. Oberholzer is not a member. When a modification is approved at the IFC level, it is approved by board members, and board members are the ones who can actually execute on the approval of those board committees. To the extent that he was required in line with his duty to sign off on any documents that are going to go to the committee, that is what he was actually doing, but he was not approving. The approval ultimately rested with the IFC, which is the board committee of which Mr. Oberholzer is not a member. As a result, I think in line with the board policy at ESCOM and also in line with the Section 75 of the Companies Act, it's very clear that he had no role whatsoever and he couldn't play any role in the approval of the modifications that were requiring the board committee, which is the IFC, of which he's not a member. Thank you.
Andre, do you want to add anything to Professor Mongalo's contribution before we Andre the writer? Andre?
Thanks, Prof. I think Professor Mongalo covered it well. Thanks, Prof. I think Professor Mongalo covered it well. Honourable Chair, with your permission, if I may proceed to addressing some of the other questions.
Okay, please proceed.
Andre, can you proceed to address the other questions so that you can save us time?
Thank you, Chair. I'll request that our Chief Legal Counsel, Bartek, yes, Prof, will do. Bartlett. Sorry, Chair, we seem to have lost our colleague somewhere along the line.
What issue do you wish me to cover?
Oh, sorry. Bottles, go ahead. The matter was concluded and we have actually settled the matter.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Chair. There are two matters in respect of which recoveries are concluded, as posed by Honourable Member Joseph. We have recouped an amount of 171 million rand from Deloitte Consulting. That matter could be taken as closed. The other matter in respect of which we successfully recovered is the McKinsey and Company. The recruitment of 1.1 billion rand. Thank you, Chair. And that matter as well could be taken as closed. The matters that are still pending are in our slides 76 to 80. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bartlett. Caleb, can you please address the quantum of the housing subsidy that is extended to Eskom employees through EFC?
Thank you, Chair. Members, in terms of the housing subsidy, it's to our bargaining unit employees. On average, a bargaining unit employee receives in the region of about 3,500 rand per month housing around the housing subsidies, and maybe let me just address the one on the neighboring countries. The only outstanding debt from our neighboring countries is with EDM Mozambique for 470 million. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kayla. If we can then move to the question around the overpayment. Thank you, Honourable Kwakwa. We will provide a detailed report as requested. We will also revert back to the committee, and I don't know the answer to the question, which of the companies that have been doing work for Eskom were involved in potential violations of the Competition Act during the period of the construction of World Cup stadiums. That was my understanding of the question, and we would need to go and look at that and cross-reference and then come back. I think just to explain the decline in the number of engineers as reported in the numbers, as Elsie explained, this is more a question of nomenclature. So instead of calling somebody an engineer, we will now call that person an operations manager or a maintenance manager. So he or she will still be doing engineering work, but will be recorded at a different level of nomenclature in the organization. So it does not mean that we are losing engineers per se. We've just changed the names of the positions. We can certainly also revert to you with what we are doing to promote the use of black professionals. We are very close with the Black Management Forum and also the Black Business Council, and we engage with them regularly. And in that capacity, they also work with us to advance the cause of black professionals, and we certainly enjoy a very positive and collaborative relationship with them. Honourable Chair, you asked a question around the average market price for coal. For the FY20 financial year, we had a budget of 537 rand per tonne. The actual cost that we achieved during FY20 was 527 rand a tonne, so slightly below budget. I just have to stress that because of differences in coal quality, mining methods, distances, the size of the seam, the quality of the reserve, within that average number there is a wide range of different prices that make up that average. Then, Jay, with regard to your question on the cost overruns, the initial cost for Medupi was 68 billion rand. And that has since increased to 145 billion rand. This does not include any interest incurred during construction, nor does it include flue gas desulfurization, which we are still required to build at Medupi. At Kusile, the initial scope of work included flue gas desulfurization, so the initial cost was higher at 84 billion rand, and the estimated total cost, again excluding interest incurred during construction, is now at 162 billion rand, and that then includes the FGD. Chair, those were the questions that I recorded as being addressed to Eskom management. Please remind me if I missed anyone.
Yes, SCOI, and then I said, with all these overruns, is it true that nobody has been held accountable, an individual or a company, and so on? Because I may be wrong, my hypothesis is that there was something illegal, let alone wrong in the process. It may be a true, a correct or wrong but you get the gist of my question.
Yes, Honourable Chair, I think the answer is twofold. On the one hand, as my colleague Avin Maharaj explained, there were various reasons why the initial cost estimate was inaccurate and why we incurred significant cost overruns. It was partly due to the fact that we started with construction while the design was not yet finalized, and this caused significant scope changes during the construction process, and scope changes always create cost overruns. Then, as you will have seen from the report with regard to the potential overpayments, in particular at Kusile, again, that my colleague, Mr. Maharaj, explained, where we have concrete evidence of overpayments, and this is the amount of 4 billion, we are working with law enforcement authorities to the extent that we are able to hold people accountable still in the employ of Eskom. That is what we do. We follow disciplinary processes, but just pointing out the obvious, we don't have powers of arrest and prosecution. And once we hand over the dockets and the cases that we've prepared to law enforcement agencies, those matters are really out of our hands. We do try and follow up, and we engage and we assist, including with the SIU, the Hawks, Asset Forfeiture Unit, and so forth. But we are not in control of those processes, and we can't drive them to their full and final legal conclusion. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. DM?
No, thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to the honored members for a very extensive engagement with Eskom. Just a few things, Chair, that I will just comment on. Firstly, it's about the capacity of the board. I think the professor did make an impassioned plea there that the board is not at the moment in full strength. It is a matter that is presently at the door of the minister, for which pending conclusion of consultations that are necessary, we should augment the board as a matter of urgency. So I would be happy to come back to the committee in respect of the progress in that respect. The matter of the capacity of the board is being considered at the highest level at DPE, at the Minister's office. And secondly, the
I just now that you are talking about the board, the prof spoke about six members of the board who have since resigned. Do you perhaps know why they resigned? Or do you care to get the reason why they resigned? If you can answer that, it's fine. If you don't, it's okay.
I'm not in a position, Chair, to say specifically now. But certainly because there would be various reasons, including exit interviews, we could come back with a composite report in that respect as to what has been found to be the... they may vary from individual to another, but surely there could be a sense made out of that as to what the circumstances were or are that the board is presently going through. I may as well just confirm, because we have not had a report to the contrary in respect of the members of the board as currently constituted, if amongst them there are indeed such divergences to a point that the board it can be construed to be at war with itself. We really do not have that, but it is indeed these questions that have to do with completing the composition, the full complement of the board. Secondly, the method I was going to comment to is what Honorable Sanguini had referred to in the latter comment, the remuneration policy for the NDP. It has since been approved, signed, from DPE point of view, it has since been signed off for execution. The third matter, just to comment on, and admittedly, Chair, if colleagues at ESCOM have a sense that our oversight instruments are not robust enough, they feel sometimes they are on their own, perhaps we have reason to look back over the instruments we have, strengthening particularly the monitoring of adherence. We do have the shareholders compact as well as the corporate plan as the instruments through which we monitor a performance of all the entities. Perhaps it's something that from the comments that they are making, we shall have to really strengthen on our part. We fully agree with the members of the committee that it cannot be, and I'm happy the professor came back to clarify the issue of the objective that within our procurement environment is there other socio-economic imperatives that must be met. Black economic empowerment is a key policy of government. It is something that cannot be not looked at in all the encounters in respect of all the bids and the decisions that are made thereof. Perhaps given the size of the spend within ESCOM, yes, we may have really had to look at the issues to do with, even as you started the meeting, Chair, you commented on load shedding that is affecting the country, affecting our meetings even right now. Perhaps there's too much focus on trying to ensure cleaner and cheaper energy for the country. We might not be having a proper look at the other things. Perhaps I agree that we should not lose sight of those, and we'll look at them, and we'll come back, and we'll be happy to come back to the committee in respect of those. Other than that, we thank you, Chair. The engagement has been a bit extensive. At least I'm happy the quality of documents that has been submitted has somewhat, I think, met the requirements that often the committees complain about. And thank you very much. We will be happy to come back to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you at DM. And perhaps let me just start where you ended. That is the question of the information that we're given, and as you have seen, your team addressed all the issues that we have raised. They addressed, and obviously there were other things which came up, and we've said that those things should be attended to, and would like you to follow up on those. The others that I've said, I think they fall squarely on the shareholders' lap, and please follow up on that one. But thank you very much. I don't want to flog a dead horse, but I think as far as Ms. Mongalo, the COO thing, right? There is. Well, I think yes, we said there's nothing wrong, but in Advocate Kassim's thing, he said the board should cancel Mr. Oppenhauser. What was it canceling for? And has the board done that before we finished? And I also heard that the only involvement of Mr. Kassim was signing. I don't know. I'm definitely not a lawyer. But when you put your signature on that, what does it mean? What is the importance of that signature? I'm still trying to work it out on my head. I don't know whether Mr. Mongalo, in a minute, would like to educate me on that one and the committee.
Chairperson?
Yes, Honorable Joseph.
Just to support you on that. Further question, my question would be if whatever Mr. Oberon have signed off, what was put before him, was that above board? That's the question one should ask also. Because if he signed off on something that he was comfortable with or not comfortable with, That is the question that one needs to ask. Besides the fact that he excused himself with the decision making, but when the information appeared before him, was that an information that he would adequately represent the company in any further other questions? Was that information that he signed off above board and acceptable? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, I allowed the Honourable Joseph to come in because I could see you itching, but I'm trying to. Mr. Mungalo, one minute.
Okay, thank you very much. When it comes to the decisions that are made in committees and in board, we are, as the board members, led by the different executive members of the organization who actually bring documents for us to see if a decision that we are taking is actually very well motivated. But the reality is we take a decision based on the information that is before us, and that information is prepared through memoranda that are prepared by the executives or other employees. And therefore, they sign just for the purposes of memorandum to be presented before committees and for us to make decisions. And that is not the decision of the organization. They are just saying this is the motivation that goes to the committee, but the committee ultimately makes a decision. And that decision is only implemented after it has been agreed upon by the committee or the board. If the matter actually ends up at committee, which is very rare, then that will be the decision of the company. But usually the committee also recommend that to the board, which finally makes a decision on the particular aspect. And therefore, in this regard, it was the decision that had to be motivated towards the IFC, and the IFC had to ultimately recommend towards the board, and the board ultimately took a decision. And Mr. Oberhauser is not a member of the IFC, and neither is he a member of the board. And that is why we're saying that he couldn't have made a decision on behalf of the organization when, in fact, that decision was for the IFC and the board.
The last part of my question, I said Advocate Kasim talked about
the cancelling.
What was it being cancelled for? That's one. And two, has that happened? And what was the outcome of that cancelling?
Yes, as far as I am aware, Advocate Kasim made a recommendation that, according to him, technically he should have totally not taken part even in the signing. And he then later on and said that falls squarely within his responsibility, and therefore he should be cancelled on the basis that he shouldn't have been involved at all. And as far as I know, the GCE has actually cancelled Mr. Oberhauser on the fact that it would have appeared that he is actually motivating on something that he is conflicted in, and therefore maybe someone else should have appended their signature. And as far as I know, that cancelling has actually led to even Mr. Oberhauser disposing of the equity investment that had actually even deteriorated to an extent that it was almost next to nothing when he disposed of it.
Okay, now you see your conclusion, and Kasim that he was not supposed to be involved at all. That's what. So
yeah, well, he said from technical point of view, but that is not what is in line with the requirements of the policy. The policy is aligned to Section 75 of the Companies Act, which says that if you are a decision maker, you cannot make a decision on the matter in which you are conflicted. You must make a declaration or a disclosure and then leave the meeting. But in this case, he was not even responsible for making a decision. The decision was that of the IFC and of the board.
Okay, that's fine. Thanks for that. And I think one thing I wouldn't be comfortable with leaving without addressing. Prof, I think the Deputy Minister did deal with where I was coming from about the Black Economic Empowerment thing and the statement that I referred to, and you explained it. But I'm a little bit worried about the conclusion that you made, that being Black doesn't mean that you should be involved in unlawful things. We are lawmakers here, and we are the last people who will say to people who are coming here that they must do things which are unlawful. It was more about addressing the broad-based Black Economic Empowerment, and I was very explicit on that. I said, do I hear you saying that when you look at these things, you don't look at Black and Crimson Empowerment? And Black and Crimson Empowerment, it has to do with correcting the racial imbalances. So race, it's inherent in that. If perhaps I was misunderstood to be saying that Black people can't be allowed to be involved in unlawful and illegal, like, I think it's definitely a wrong understanding. I just thought let me correct that. But I think the oral members would agree with me, Deputy Minister, that as you have said, that the engagement has helped us, and also I think it has helped you, as you have said, the issues that we've raised in our responsibility, and based on the Money Bills Act. That's the act which empowers us to engage with you in the manner we've done. There's no doubt that the role that ESCOM plays in the socio-economic conditions of the country, it's a role which can't be played by anyone, at least for now. When ESCOM coughs, the whole economy catches the cold. But thank you very much, everybody who has attended. I would also like to thank the honorable members and everybody involved, Deputy Minister, Chairperson, Team ESCOM, CEO, the executives who are here. Thank you very much. This brings us to the end of the meeting. Honorable members, I know that we're still having meet National Treasury. Thanks for coming. Darren, I know that you still have got minutes, but I think we'll attend the minutes. We'll try to do the minutes at the next meeting. But thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah,